and a cook named Uma. Uma liked to talk as she worked, but Arya could not understand a word she said. The others had no names, or did not choose to share them. One serving man was very old, his back bent like a bow. The second was red-faced, with hair growing from his ears. She took them both for mutes until she heard them praying. The acolytes were younger. The eldest was her father's age. The other two could not have been much older than Sansa, who had been her sister. The acolytes wore black and white too, but their robes had no cowls, and were black on the left side and white on the right. With the kindly man and the waif, it was the opposite. Arya was given servant's garb, a tunic of undyed wool, baggy breeches, linen small clothes, cloth slippers for her feet. Only the kindly man knew the common tongue. "Who are you?" he would ask her every day.
"Ah, no one," she would answer.
She who had been Arya of House Stark, Arya Underfoot, Arya Horseface. She had been Arya and Weasel too, and Squab and Salty. Nan the cupbearer, a grey mouse, a sheep, the ghost of Harrenhal. But not for true. Not in her heart of hearts. In there she was Arya of Winterfell, the daughter of Lord Eddard Stark and Lady Catelyn, who had once had brothers named Rob and Bran and Rickon, a sister named Sansa, a direwolf called Nymeria, a half-brother named Jon Snow. In there she was someone, but that was not the answer that he wanted. Without a common language, Arya had no way of talking to the others. She listened to them, though, and repeated the words she heard to herself as she went about her work. Though the youngest acolyte was blind, he had charge of the candles. He would walk the temple in soft slippers, surrounded by the murmurings of the old women who came each day to pray. Even without eyes, he always knew which candles had gone out.
"He has the scent to guide him," the kindly man explained, "and the air is warmer where a candle burns."
He told Arya to close her eyes and try it for herself. They prayed at dawn before they broke their fast, kneeling around the still black pool. Some days the kindly man led the prayer, other days it was the waif. Arya only knew a few words of Bravassi, the ones that were the same in High Valyrian. So she prayed her own prayer to the many-faced god, the one that went,
"Sir Gregor, Donson, Rafe the Sweetling, Sir Ilion, Sir Meryn, Queen Cersei."
She prayed in silence. If the many-faced god was a proper god, he would hear her. Worshippers came to the House of Black and White every day. Most came alone and sat alone. They lit candles at one altar or another, prayed beside the pool, and sometimes wept. A few drank from the black cup and went to sleep. More did not drink. There were no services, no songs, no paeans of praise to please the god. The temple was never full. From time to time a worshipper would ask to see a priest, and the kindly man or the waif would take him down into the sanctum. But that did not happen often. 30 different guards stood along the walls, surrounded by their little lights. The weeping woman was the favorite of old women, Arya saw. Rich men preferred the Lion of Night, poor men the Hooded Wayfarer. Soldiers lit candles to Bacchalon, the Pale Child. Sailors to Moon-Pale Maiden and the Merlin King. The stranger had his shrine as well, though hardly anyone ever came to him. Most of the time only a single candle stood flickering at his feet. The kindly man said it did not matter. He has many faces and many ears to hear. The knoll on which the temple stood was honeycombed with passageways hewn from the rock. The priests and acolytes had their sleeping cells on the first level, Arya and the servants on the second. The lowest level was forbidden to all save the priests. That was where the holy sanctum lay.
When she was not working, Arya was free to wander as she would amongst the vaults and storerooms, so long as she did not leave the temple, nor descend to the third cellar. She found a room full of weapons and armour, ornate helms and curious old breastplates, long swords, daggers and dirks, crossbows and tall spears with leaf-shaped heads. Another vault was crammed with clothing, thick furs and splendid silks in 50 colours, next to piles of foul-smelling rags and threadbare rough-spuns.
There must be treasure chambers, too,
Arya decided. She pictured stacks of golden plates, bags of silver coins, sapphires blue as the sea, ropes of fat green pearls. One day the kindly man came on her unexpectedly and asked what she was doing. She told him that she had gotten lost.
You lie. Worse, you lie poorly. Who are you?
Hath no one.
Another lie, he sighed.
Whis would have beaten her bloody if he'd caught her in a lie, but it was different in the House of Black and White. When she was helping in the kitchen, Umar would sometimes smack her with her spoon if she got in the way, but no one else ever raised a hand to her.
They only raise their hands to kill, she thought.
She got along well enough with the cook. Umar would slap a knife into her hand and point at an onion, and Arya would chop it. Umar would shove her toward a mound of dough, and Arya would knead it, until the cook said, stop. Stop was the first Bravasi word she learned. Umar would hand her a fish, and Arya would bone it and fillet it and roll it in the nuts the cook was crushing. The brackish waters that surrounded Bravas teemed with fish and shellfish, of every sort, the kindly man explained. A slow brown river entered the lagoon from the south, wandering through a wide expanse of reeds, tidal pools, and mudflats. Clams and cockles abounded thereabouts, mussels and muskfish, frogs and turtles, mud crabs and leopard crabs, and climber crabs, red eels, black eels, striped eels, lampreys, and oysters, all made frequent appearances on the carved wooden table where the servants of the many-faced god took their meals. Some nights Umar spiced the fish with sea salt and cracked peppercorns, or cooked the eels with chopped garlic. Once in a great while the cook would even use some saffron.
Hot pie would have liked it here, Arya thought.
Supper was her favourite time. It had been a long while since Arya had gone to sleep every night with a full belly. Some nights the kindly man would allow her to ask him questions. Once she asked him why the people who came to the temple always seemed so peaceful. Back home, people were scared to die. She remembered how that pimply squire had wept when she stabbed him in the belly, and the way Sir Amory Lorch had begged when the goat had him thrown in the bear pit. She remembered the village by the God's Eye, and the way the villagers shrieked and screamed and whimpered whenever the tickler started asking after gold.
Death is not the worst thing, the kindly man replied. It is his gift to us, an end to want and pain. On the day that we are born, the many-faced God sends each of us a dark angel to walk through life beside us. When our sins and our sufferings grow too great to be borne, the angel takes us by the hand to lead us to the nightlands, where the stars burn ever bright. Those who come to drink from the black cup are looking for their angels. If they are afraid, the candles soothe them. When you smell our candles burning, what does it make you think of, my child?
Winterfell, she might have said. I smell snow and smoke and pine needles. I smell the stables. I smell Hodar laughing and John and Rob battling in the yard, and Sansa singing about some stupid lady fair. I smell the crypts where the stone kings sit. I smell hot bread baking. I smell the godswood. I smell my wolf. I smell her fur, almost as if she were still beside me.
I don't smell anything, she said,
to see what he would say.
You lie, he said, but you may keep your secrets if you wish. Arya of House Stark. He only called her that when she displeased him. You know that you may leave this place. You are not one of us, not yet. You may go home any time you wish.
You told me that if I left, I couldn't come back.
Just so.
Those words made her sad.
Sirio used to say that too,
Arya remembered.
He said it all the time.
Sirio Forrell had taught her needlework and died for her.
I don't want to leave.
Then stay. But remember, the House of Black and White is not a home for orphans. All men must serve beneath this roof. Volar Dehaerys is how we say it here. Remain if you will, but know that we shall require your obedience. At all times and in all things, if you cannot obey, you must depart.
I can obey.
We shall see.
She had other tasks beside helping Uma. She swept the temple floors. She served and poured at meals. She sorted piles of dead men's clothing, emptied their purses, and counted out stacks of queer coins. Every morning she walked beside the kindly man as he made his circuit of the temple to find the dead.
Silent as a shadow,
she would tell herself, remembering Sirio. She carried a lantern with thick iron shutters. At each alcove, she would open the shutter a crack to look for corpses. The dead were never hard to find. They came to the House of Black and White, prayed for an hour or a day or a year, drank sweet, dark water from the pool, and stretched out on a stone bed behind one guard or another. They closed their eyes and slept, and never woke.
The gift of the many-faced god takes myriad forms, the kindly man told her, but here it is always gentle.
When they found a body, he would say a prayer and make certain life had fled, and Arya would fetch the serving men, whose task it was to carry the dead down to the vaults. There acolytes would strip and wash the bodies. The dead men's clothes and coins and valuables went into a bin for sorting. Their cold flesh would be taken to the lower sanctum, where only the priest could go. What happened in there, Arya was not allowed to know. Once, as she was eating her supper, a terrible suspicion seized hold of her, and she put down her knife and stared suspiciously at a slice of pale white meat. The kindly man saw the horror on her face.
It is pork, child, he told her. Only pork.
Her bed was stone and reminded her of Harrenhal and the bed she'd slept in when scrubbing steps for Whis. The mattress was stuffed with rags instead of straw, which made it lumpier than the one she'd had at Harrenhal, but less scratchy, too. She was allowed as many blankets as she wished, thick woolen blankets, red and green and plaid, and her cell was hers alone. She kept her treasures there, the silver fork and floppy hat and fingerless gloves given her by the sailors on the Titan's Daughter, her dagger, boots and belt, her small store of coins, the clothes she had been wearing, and needle. Though her duties left her little time for needlework, she practiced when she could, dueling with her shadow by the light of a blue candle. One night the waif happened to be passing and saw Arya at her swordplay. The girl did not say a word, but the next day the kindly man walked Arya back to her cell.
You need to rid yourself of all this, he said of her treasures.
Arya felt stricken.
They're mine.
And who are you?
No one.
He picked up her silver fork.
This belongs to Arya of House Stark. All these things belong to her. There is no place for them here. there is no place for her. Hers is too proud a name, and we have no room for pride. We are servants here.
I serve,
she said, wounded. She liked the silver fork. You play at being a servant, but in your heart you are a lord's daughter. You have taken other names, but you wore them as lightly as you might wear a gown. Under them was always Arya.
I don't wear gowns. You can't fight in a stupid gown.
Why would you wish to fight? Are you some bravo, strutting through the alleys, spoiling for blood? He sighed. Before you drink from the cold cup, you must offer up all you are to him of many faces, your body, your soul, yourself. If you cannot bring yourself to do that, you must leave this place. The iron coin has paid your passage here. From this point, you must pay your own way, and the cost is dear.
I don't have any gold.
What we offer cannot be bought with gold. The cost is all of you. Men take many paths through this vale of tears and pain. Ours is the hardest. Few are made to walk it. It takes uncommon strength of body and spirit, and a heart both hard and strong. I have a hole where my heart should be, she thought, and nowhere else to go.
I'm strong. As strong as you. I'm hard.
You believe this is the only place for you? It was as if he'd heard her thoughts. You are wrong in that. You would find a softer service in the household of some merchant. You would sooner be a courtesan and have songs sung of your beauty. Speak the word, and we will send you to the Black Pearl, or the Daughter of the Dusk. You will sleep on rose petals, and wear silken shirts that rustle when you walk, and great lords will beggar themselves for your maiden's blood. Or if it is marriage and children you desire, tell me, and we shall find a husband for you. Some honest apprentice boy, a rich old man, a seafarer, whatever you desire.
She wanted none of that. Wordless, she shook her head.
Is it Westeros you dream of, child? Luco Prestaine's Lady Bright leaves upon the morrow for Gulltown, Duskendale, King's Landing, and Tyrosh. Shall we find you passage on her?
I only just came from Westeros.
Sometimes it seemed 1,000 years since she had fled King's Landing, and sometimes it seemed like only yesterday. But she knew she could not go back.
I'll go, if you don't want me. But I won't go there.
My wants do not matter, said the kindly man. It may be that the many-faced god has led you here to be his instrument. And when I look at you, I see a child. And worse, a girl child. Many have served him of many faces through the centuries, but only a few of his servants have been women. Women bring life into the world. We bring the gift of death. No one can do both.
He's trying to scare me away, Arya thought, the way he did with the worm. I don't care about that.
You should. Stay, and the many-faced god will take your ears, your nose, your tongue. He will take your sad grey eyes that have seen so much. He will take your hands, your feet, your arms and legs, your private parts. He will take your hopes and dreams, your loves and hates. Those who enter his service must give up all that makes them who they are. Can you do that? He cupped her chin and gazed deep into her eyes,
so deep it made her shiver.
No, he said, I do not think you can.
Arya knocked his hand away.
I could if I wanted to.
So says Arya of Hastark,
Eater of grave worms.
I can give up anything I want.
He gestured at her treasures.
Then start with these.
That night after supper, Arya went back to her cell and took off her robe and whispered her names. But sleep refused to take her. She tossed on her mattress, stuffed with rags, gnawing on her lip. She could feel the hole inside her, where her heart had been.
In the black of night she rose again, donned the clothes she'd worn from Westeros, and buckled on her sword belt. Needle hung over one hip, her dagger from the other. With her floppy hat on her head, her fingerless gloves tucked into her belt, and her silver fork in one hand, she went stealing up the steps.
There is no place here for Arya of House Stark, she was thinking.
Arya's place was Winterfell, only Winterfell was gone.
When the snows fall and the white winds blow, the lone wolf dies, but the pack survives.
She had no pack, though. They had killed her pack. Sir Ilyen and Sir Meryn and the Queen. And when she tried to make a new one, all of them ran off. Hotpie and Gendry and Yoren and Lummy Greenhands, even Harwin, who had been her father's man. She shoved through the doors, out into the night. It was the first time she had been outside since entering the temple. The sky was overcast, and fog covered the ground like a frayed grey blanket. Off to her right she heard paddling from the canal. Braavos, the secret city, she thought. The name seemed very apt. She crept down the steep steps to the covered dock, the mist swirling round her feet. It was so foggy she could not see the water, but she heard it lapping softly at stone pilings. In the distance, a light glowed through the gloom. The night fire at the Temple of the Red Priest, she thought. At the water's edge she stopped, the silver fork in hand. It was real silver, solid through and through.
It's not my fork. It was Salty that he gave it to.
She tossed it underhand, heard the soft plop as it sank below the water. Her floppy hat went next, then the gloves. They were Salty's too. She emptied her pouch into her palm, 5 silver stags, 9 copper stars, some pennies and half pennies and groats. She scattered them across the water. Next, her boots. They made the loudest splash. Her dagger followed, the one she'd gotten off the archer, who begged the hound for mercy. Her sword belt went into the canal, her cloak, tunic, breeches, small clothes, all of it, all but needle. She stood on the end of the dock, pale and goose-fleshed and shivering in the fog. In her hand, Needle seemed to whisper to her.
"Stick them with a pointy end," it said, "and don't tell Sansa."
Mickon's mark was on the blade.
"It's just a sword."
If she needed a sword, there were 100 under the temple. Needle was too small to be a proper sword. It was hardly more than a toy. She had been a stupid little girl when John had it made for her.
"It's just a sword," she said aloud this time.
But it wasn't. Needle was Rob and Bran and Rickon, her mother and her father, even Sansa. Needle was Winterfell's grey walls and the laughter of its people. Needle was the summer snows, old Nan's stories, the heart tree with its red leaves and scary face, the warm earthy smell of the glass gardens, the sound of the north wind rattling the shutters of her room. Needle was Jon Snow's smile.
"He used to mess my hair, and called me Little Sister,"
she remembered, and suddenly there were tears in her eyes. Polyver had stolen the sword from her when the Mountain's men took her captive, but when she and the Hound walked into the inn at the crossroads, there it was.
"The guards wanted me to have it."
Not the 7, nor him of many faces, but her father's guards, the old guards of the north.
"The many-faced guard can have the rest," she thought, "but he can't have this."
She padded up the steps as naked as her name day, clutching needle. Halfway up, one of the stones rocked beneath her feet. Arya knelt and dug around its edges with her fingers. It would not move at first, but she persisted, picking at the crumbling mortar with her nails. Finally, the stone shifted. She grunted and got both hands in and pulled. A crack opened before her.
"You'll be safe here," she told Needle. "No one will know where you are but me."
She pushed the sword and sheath behind the step, then shoved the stone back into place, so it looked like all the other stones. As she climbed back to the temple, she counted steps, so she would know where to find the sword again. One day, she might have need of it.
"One day,"
she whispered to herself. She never told the kindly man what she had done, yet he knew. The next night he came to her cell after supper.
"Child," he said, "come sit with me. I have a tale to tell you."
"What kind of tale?"
she asked, weary.
"The tale of our beginnings. If you would be one of us, you had best know who we are and how we came to be. Men may whisper of the faceless men of Braavos, but we are older than the secret city. Before the Titan rose, before the unmasking of Uthera, before the founding, we were. We have flowered in Braavos amongst these northern fogs, but we first took root in Valeria, amongst the wretched slaves who toiled in the deep mines beneath the 14 flames that lit the freehold's nights of old. Most mines are dank and chilly places, cut from cold, dead stone. But the 14 flames were living mountains with veins of molten rock and hearts of fire. So the mines of Ovaleria were always hot, and they grew hotter when the shafts were driven deeper, ever deeper. The slaves toiled in an oven. The rocks around them were too hot to touch. The air stank of brimstone and would sear their lungs as they breathed it. The soles of their feet would burn and blister, even through the thickest sandals. Sometimes, when they broke through a wall in search of gold, they would find steam instead, or boiling water, or molten rock. Certain shafts were cut so low that the slaves could not stand upright, but had to crawl or bend. And there were worms in that red darkness, too.
"Earthworms?"
she asked, frowning. "Fireworms. Some say they are akin to dragons, for worms breathe fire, too. Instead of soaring through the sky, they bore through stone and soil. If the old tales can be believed, there were worms amongst the 14 flames, even before the dragons came. The young ones are no larger than that skinny arm of yours, but they can grow to monstrous size and have no love for men."
"Did they kill the slaves?"
"Burnt and blackened corpses were oft found in shafts where the rocks were cracked or full of holes. Yet still the mines drove deeper. Slaves perished by the score, but their masters did not care. Red gold and yellow gold and silver were reckoned to be more precious than the lives of slaves, for slaves were cheap in the old freehold. During war, the Valerians took them by the thousands. In times of peace, they bred them, though only the worst were sent down to die in the red darkness."
"Didn't the slaves rise up and fight?"
"Some did," he said. "Revolts were common in the mines, but few accomplished much. The dragon lords of the old freehold were strong in sorcery, and lesser men defied them at their peril. The first faceless man was one who did."
"Who was he?"
Arya blurted, before she stopped to think.
"No one," he answered. "Some say he was a slave himself. Others insist he was a freeholder's son, born of noble stock. Some will even tell you he was an overseer who took pity on his charges. The truth is, no one knows.
Whoever he was, he moved amongst the slaves and would hear them at their prayers. Men of 100 different nations laboured in the mines, and each prayed to his own God in his own tongue. Yet all were praying for the same thing. It was release they asked for, an end to pain. A small thing, and simple. Yet their gods made no answer, and their suffering went on. Are their gods all deaf? He wondered. Until realization came upon him, one night in the red darkness. All gods have their instruments, men and women who serve them, and help to work their will on earth. The slaves were not crying out to 100 different gods, as it seemed, but to one God with 100 different faces, and he was that God's instrument. That very night he chose the most wretched of the slaves, the one who had prayed most earnestly for release, and freed him from his bondage. The first gift had been given. Arya drew back from him. He killed the slave. That did not sound right. He should have killed the masters. He would bring the gift to them as well. But that is a tale for another day, one best shared with no one. He cocked his head. And who are you, child?
No one.
A lie.
How do you know? Is it magic?
A man does not need to be a wizard to know truth from falsehood. Not if he has eyes. You need only learn to read a face. Look at the eyes, the mouth, the muscles here at the corner of the jaw, and here, where the neck joins the shoulders. He touched her lightly with two fingers. Some liars blink, some stare, some look away, some lick their lips. Many cover their mouths just before they tell a lie, as if to hide their deceit. Other signs may be more subtle, but they are always there. A false smile and a true one may look alike, but they are as different as dusk from dawn. Can you tell dusk from dawn?
Arya nodded, though she was not certain that she could.
Then you can learn to see a lie, and once you do, no secret will be safe from you.
Teach me.
She would be no one, if that was what it took. No one had no holes inside her.
She will teach you,
said the kindly man, as a waif appeared outside her door. Starting with the tongue of Braavos, what use are you if you cannot speak or understand? And you shall teach her your own tongue. The two of you shall learn together, each from the other. Will you do this?
Yes, she said,
and from that moment she was a novice in the house of black and white. Her servant's garb was taken away, and she was given a robe to wear, a robe of black and white, as buttery soft as the old red blanket she'd once had at Winterfell. Beneath it she wore small clothes of fine white linen, and a black undertunic that hung down past her knees. Thereafter she and the waif spent their time together, touching things and pointing, as each tried to teach the other a few words of her own tongue. Simple words at first, cup and candle and shoe, and then harder words, then sentences. Once Sirio Forel used to make Arya stand on one leg until she was trembling. Later he sent her chasing after cats. She had danced the water dance on the limbs of trees, a stick sword in her hand. Those things had all been hard, but this was harder.
Even sewing was more fun than tongues, she told herself, after a night when she had forgotten half the words she thought she knew,
and pronounced the other half so badly that the waif had laughed at her.
My sentences are as crooked as my stitches used to be.
If the girl had not been so small and starved, Arya would have smashed her stupid face. Instead, she gnawed her lip.
Too stupid to learn, and too stupid to give up.
the common tongue came to the waif more quickly. One day, at supper, she turned to Arya and asked,
"Who are you?"
"No one," Arya answered in bravosi.
"You lie," said the waif. "You must lie gooder."
Arya laughed.
"A gooder? You mean better, stupid." "Better, stupid, I will show you."
The next day they began the lying game, asking questions of one another, taking turns. Sometimes they would answer truly, sometimes they would lie. The questioner had to try and tell what was true and what was false. The waif always seemed to know. Arya had to guess. Most of the time she guessed wrong.
"How many years have you?"
the waif asked her once in the common tongue.
10,
said Arya, and raised 10 fingers. She thought she was still 10, but it was hard to know for certain. The Bravasi counted days differently than they did in Westeros. For all she knew, her name day had come and gone. The waif nodded. Arya nodded back, and in her best Bravasi said,
"How many years have you?"
The waif showed 10 fingers, then 10 again, yet again, then 6. Her face remained as smooth as still water.
"She can't be 36, Arya thought. "She's a little girl."
"You're lying," she said. The waif shook her head and showed her once again, 10, 10, 10, and 6. She said the words for 36 and made Arya say them too. The next day she told the kindly man what the waif had claimed.
"She did not lie,"
the priest said, chuckling.
"The one you call waif is a woman grown, who has spent her life serving him of many faces. She gave him all she was, all she ever might have been, all the lives that were within her."
Arya bit her lip.
"Will I be like her?"
"No," he said, "not unless you wish it.
It is the poisons that have made her, as you see her." "Poisons?"
She understood then. Every evening after prayer, the waif emptied a stone flagon into the waters of the Black Pool. The waif and kindly man were not the only servants of the many-faced god. From time to time, others would visit the house of Black and White. The fat fellow had fierce black eyes, a hooked nose, and a wide mouth full of yellow teeth. The stern face never smiled. His eyes were pale, his lips full and dark. The handsome man had a beard a different colour every time she saw him, and a different nose. But he was never less than comely. Those three came most often, but there were others. The squinter, the lordling, the starved man. One time the fat fellow and the squinter came together. Uma sent Arya to pour for them.
"When you are not pouring, you must stand as still as if you've been carved of stone,"
the kindly man told her.
"Can you do that?"
"Yes."
"Before you can learn to move, you must learn to be still."
Cyrio Forel had taught her long ago at King's Landing, and she had. She had served as Roose Bolton's cupbearer at Harrenhal, and he would flay you if you spilled his wine.
"Good," the kindly man said. "It would be best if you were blind and deaf as well. You may hear things, but you must let them pass in one ear and out the other. Do not listen."
Arya heard much and more that night, but almost all of it was in the tongue of Braavos, and she hardly understood one word in 10.
"Still as stone," she told herself.
The hardest part was struggling not to yawn. Before the night was done, her wits were wandering. Standing there with a flagon in her hands, she dreamed she was a wolf, running free through a moonlit forest with a great pack howling at her heels.
"Are the other men all priests?"
she asked the kindly man the next morning.
"Were those their real faces?"
"What do you think, child?" She thought, no.
"Is Jaqen H'ghar a priest, too? Do you know if Jaqen will be coming back to Braavos?"
"Who?" he said, all innocence.
"Jaqen H'ghar. He gave me the iron coin."
"I know no one by this name, child."
"I asked him how he changed his face, and he said it was no harder than taking a new name. if you knew the way.
Did he?
Will you show me how to change my face?
If you wish.
He cupped her chin in his hand and turned her head. Puff up your cheeks and stick out your tongue. Arya puffed up her cheeks and stuck out her tongue. There, your face is changed.
That's not how I meant. Jay can use magic.
All sorcery comes at a cost, child. Years of prayer and sacrifice and study are required to work a proper glamour.
Years, she said, dismayed. If it were easy, all men would do it. You must walk before you run. Why use a spell when mummer's tricks will serve?
I don't know any mummer's tricks either.
Then practice making faces. Beneath your skin are muscles. Learn to use them. It is your face, your cheeks, your lips, your ears. Smiles and scowls should not come upon you like sudden squalls. A smile should be a servant, and come only when you call it. Learn to rule your face.
Show me how.
Puff up your cheeks, she did. Lift your eyebrows. No, higher.
She did that too.
Good. See how long you can hold that. It will not be long. Try it again on the morrow. You will find a mirrorish mirror in the vaults. Train before it for an hour every day. Eyes, nostrils, cheeks, ears, lips. Learn to rule them all.
He cupped her chin.
Who are you?
No one.
A lie. A sad little lie, child. She found the mirrorish mirror the next day, and every morn and every night she sat before it with a candle on each side of her, making faces.
Fool your face, she told herself, and you can lie.
Soon thereafter the kindly man commanded her to help the other acolytes prepare the corpses. The work was not near as hard as scrubbing steps for Weiss. Sometimes, if the corpse was big or fat, she would struggle with the weight. But most of the dead were old dried bones in wrinkled skins. Arya would look at them as she washed them, wondering what brought them to the black pool. She remembered a tale she had heard from old Nan, about how, sometimes during a long winter, men who'd lived beyond their years would announce that they were going hunting.
And their daughters would weep, and their sons would turn their faces to the fire, she could hear old Nan saying. But no one would stop them, or ask what game they meant to hunt, with the snow so deep and the cold wind howling.
She wondered what the old Bravossi had told their sons and daughters before they set off for the house of black and white. The moon turned and turned again, though Arya never saw it. She served, washed the dead, made faces at the mirrors, learned the Bravossi tongue, and tried to remember that she was no one. One day the kindly man sent for her.
Your accent is a horror, he said. But you have enough words to make your wants understood after a fashion. It is time that you left us for a while. The only way you will ever truly master our tongue is if you speak it every day from dawn to dusk. You must go.
When?
She asked him. Where?
Now, he answered. Beyond these walls you will find the 100 isles of Bravas in the sea. You have been taught the words for mussels, cockles, and clams, have you not?
Yes,
she repeated them in her best Bravossi. Her best Bravossi made him smile.
It will serve.
Along the wharf below the drowned town you will find a fishmonger named Brusco, a good man with a bad back. He has need of a girl to push his barrow and sell his cockles, clams, and mussels to the sailors off the ships. You shall be that girl. Do you understand?
Yes.
And when Brusco asks, who are you?
No one.
No, that will not serve outside this house. She hesitated.
I could be salty from salt pans.
As salty is known to Tanisio Teres and the men of the Titan's daughter,
You are marked by the way you speak, so you must be some girl of Westeros. What a different girl, I think.
She bit her lip.
Could I be Cat?
Cat,
he considered.
Yes, Braffos is full of cats. One more will not be noticed. You are Cat, an orphan of King's Landing.
She had visited White Harbour with her father twice, but she knew King's Landing better.
Just so. Your father was oar master on a galley. When your mother died, he took you off to sea with him. Then he died as well, and his captain had no use for you. So he put you off the ship in Braavos. And what was the name of the ship?
Nymeria,
she said at once. That night she left the house of Black and White. A long iron knife rode on her right hip, hidden by her cloak, a patched and faded thing of the sort an orphan might wear. Her shoes pinched her toes, and her tunic was so threadbare that the wind cut right through it. But Braavos lay before her. The night air smelled of smoke and salt and fish. The canals were crooked, the alleys crookeder. Men gave her curious looks as she went past, and beggar children called out words she could not understand. Before long, she was completely lost.
Sir Gregor,
she chanted, as she crossed a stone bridge supported by four archers. From the centre of its span, she could see the masts of ships in the Ragman's harbour.
Donson, Rafe the Sweetling, Sir Ilion, Sir Meryn, Queen Cersei.
Rain began to fall. Arya turned her face up to let the raindrops wash her cheeks.
So happy she could dance. Valar Morghulis, she said. Valar Morghulis. Valar Morghulis.
Elaine. As the rising sun came streaming through the windows, Elaine sat up in bed and stretched. Gretchel heard her stir and rose at once to fetch her bedrobe. The rooms had grown chilly during the night. It will be worse when winter has us in its grip, she thought. Winter will make this place as cold as any tomb. Elaine slipped into the robe and belted it about her waist.
The fire is almost out, she observed. Put another log on, if you would.
As my lady wishes,
the old woman said.
Elaine's apartments in the Maiden's Tower were larger and more lavish than the little bedchamber where she'd been kept when Lady Lysa was alive. She had a dressing room and a privy of her own now, and a balcony of carved white stone that looked off across the vale. Whilst Gretchel was tending to the fire, Elaine padded barefoot across the room and slipped outside. The stone was cold beneath her feet, and the wind was blowing fiercely, as it always did up here, but the view made her forget all that for half a heartbeat. Maidens was the easternmost of the Eyrie's seven slender towers, so she had the vale before her, her forests and rivers and fields all hazy in the morning light. The way the sun was hitting the mountains made them look like solid gold. So lovely. The snow-clad summit of the Giant's Lance loomed above her, an immensity of stone and ice that dwarfed the castle perched upon its shoulder. Icicles 20 feet long draped the lip of the precipice where Lysa's tears fell in summer. A falcon soared above the frozen waterfall. Blue wings spread wide against the morning sky. Would that I had wings as well. She rested her hands on the carved stone balustrade and made herself peer over the edge. She could see sky 600 feet below and the stone steps carved into the mountain, the winding way that led past snow and stone all the way down to the valley floor. She could see the towers and keeps of the Gates of the Moon, as small as a child's toys. Around the walls, the hosts of Lords Declarant were stirring, emerging from their tents like ants from an anthill. If only they were truly ants, she thought. We could step on them and crush them. Young Lord Hunter and his levies had joined the others 2 days past. Nestor Royce had closed the gates against them, but he had fewer than 300 men in his garrison. Each of the Lords Declarant had brought 1,000, and there were 6 of them. Elaine knew their names as well as her own. Benadar Belmore, Lord of Strongsong, Simon Templeton, the Knight of 9 Stars, Horton Redfort, Lord of Redfort, Anya Wainwood, Lady of Iron Oaks, Gilwood Hunter, called Young Lord Hunter by all and sundry, Lord of Longbow Hall, and Yon Royce, mightiest of them all, the redoubtable Bronze Yon, Lord of Runestone, Nestor's cousin, and the chief of the senior branch of House Royce. The 6 had gathered at Runestone after Lysa Aaron's fall, and there made a pact together, vowing to defend Lord Robert, the Vale, and one another. Their declaration made no mention of the Lord Protector, but spoke of misrule that must be ended, and of false friends and evil counsellors as well. A cold gust of wind blew up her legs. She went inside to choose a gun to break her fast in. Peter had given her his late wife's wardrobe, a wealth of silks, satins, velvets, and furs, far beyond anything she had ever dreamed, though the great bulk of it was far too large for her. Lady Lysa had grown very stout during her long succession of pregnancies, stillbirths, and miscarriages. A few of the oldest gowns had been made for young Lysa Tully of River Run, however, and others Gretchel had been able to alter to fit Elaine, who was almost as long of leg at 3 and 10 as her aunt had been at 20. This morning her eye was caught by a party-coloured gown of Tully red and blue, lined with vair. Gretchel helped her slide her arms into the belled sleeves and laced her back, then brushed and pinned her hair. Elaine had darkened it again last night before she went to bed. The wash her aunt had given her changed her own rich auburn into Elaine's burnt brown, but it was seldom long before the red began creeping back at the roots. And what must I do when the dye runs out? The wash had come from Tyrish, across the narrow sea. As she went down to break her fast, Elaine was struck again by the stillness of the area. There was no quieter castle in all the 7 kingdoms. The servants here were few and old, and kept their voices down so as not to excite the young lord. There were no horses on the mountain, no hounds to bark and growl, no knights training in the yard. Even the footsteps of the guards seemed strangely muffled as they walked the pale stone halls. She could hear the wind moaning and sighing round the towers, but that was all. When she had first come to Eyrie, there had been the murmur of Elisa's tears as well, but the waterfall was frozen now. Gretchel said it would stay silent till the spring. She found Lord Robert alone in the morning hall, above the kitchens, pushing a wooden spoon listlessly through a big bowl of porridge and honey.
"I wanted eggs," he complained when he saw her. "I wanted 3 eggs, boiled soft, and some back bacon."
They had no eggs, no more than they had bacon. The area's granaries held sufficient oats and corn and barley to feed them for a year, but they depended on a bastard girl named Maya Stone to bring fresh foodstuffs up from the valley floor. With the Lord's Declarant encamped at the foot of the mountain, there was no way for Maya to get through. Lord Belmore, first of the 6 to reach the gates, had sent a raven to tell Littlefinger that no more food would go up to the area until he sent Lord Robert down. It was not quite a siege, not as yet, but it was the next best thing. "You can have eggs when Maya comes, as many as you like," Elaine promised the little lordling. "She'll bring eggs and butter and melons, all sorts of tasty things." The boy was unappeased.
"I wanted eggs today."
"Sweet Robin, there are no eggs, you know that. Please eat your porridge, it's very nice." She ate a spoonful of her own. Robert pushed his spoon across the bowl and back, but never brought it to his lips.
"I'm not hungry," he decided. "I want to go back to bed. I never slept last night. I heard singing. Maester Coleman gave me dream wine, but I could still hear it."
Elaine put down her spoon. "If there had been singing, I should have heard it too. You had a bad dream, that's all."
"No, it wasn't a dream."
Tears filled his eyes.
"Marillion was singing again. Your father says he's dead, but he isn't."
"He is." It frightened her to hear him talk like this. Bad enough that he is small and sickly. What if he is mad as well? "Sweet Robin, he is. Marillion loved your lady mother too much and could not live with what he'd done to her. So he walked into the sky." Elaine had not seen the body, no more than Robert had, but she did not doubt the fact of the singer's death. "He's gone, truly."
"But I hear him every night, even when I close the shutters and put a pillow on my head. Your father should have cut his tongue out. I told him to, but he wouldn't."
He needed a tongue to confess. "Be a good boy and eat your porridge," Elaine pleaded. "Please, for me."
"I don't want porridge."
Robert flung his spoon across the hall. It bounced off a hanging tapestry and left a smear of porridge upon a white silk moon.
"The Lord wants eggs."
"The Lord shall eat porridge, and be thankful for it,"
said Peter's voice behind them. Elaine turned and saw him in the doorway arch, with Maester Coleman at his side.
"You should heed the Lord Protector, my lord,"
the maester said.
"Your lord's bannermen are coming up the mountain to pay you homage, so you will need all your strength."
Robert rubbed his left eye with a knuckle.
"Send them away. I don't want them. If they come, I'll make them fly."
"You tempt me sorely, my lord, but I fear I promise them safe conduct," said Peter.
"In any case, it's too late to turn them back. By now they may have climbed as far as stone."
"Why won't they leave us be?" wailed Elaine. "We never did them any harm. What do they want of us?"
"Just Lord Robert, him, and the veil," Peter smiled. "There will be eight of them. Lord Nestor is showing them up, and they have Lynn Corbury with them. Sir Lynn is not the sort of man to stay away when blood is in the offing."
His words did little to soothe her fears. Lynn Corbury had slain almost as many men in duels as he had in battle. He had won his spurs during Robert's rebellion, she knew, fighting first against Lord John Arryn at the gates of Gulltown, and later beneath his banners on the Trident, where he had cut down Prince Lewin of Dorne, a white knight of the King's Guard. Peter said that Prince Lewin had been sorely wounded by the time the tide of battle swept him to his final dance with Lady Forlorn, but added, "That's not a point you'll want to raise with Corbury, though. Those who do are soon given a chance to ask Martell himself the truth of it, down in the halls of hell." If even half of what she had heard from Lord Robert's guards were true, Lynn Corbury was more dangerous than all six of the Lord's declarant put together. "Why is he coming?" she asked. "I thought the Corbrys were for you."
"Lord Lionel Corbury is well disposed toward my rule," said Peter. "But his brother goes his own way. On the Trident, when their father fell wounded, it was Lynn who snatched up Lady Forlorn and slew the man who cut him down, whilst Lionel was carrying the old man back to the maesters in the rear. Lynn led his charge against the Dornishmen, threatening Robert's left, broke their lines to pieces, and slew Lewin Martell. So when old Lord Corbury died, he bestowed the lady upon his younger son. Lionel got his lands, his title, his castle, and all his coin, yet still feels he was cheated of his birthright. While Sir Lynn, well, he loves Lionel as much as he loves me. He wanted Lysa's hand for himself."
"I don't like Sir Lynn,"
Robert insisted.
"I won't have him here. You send him back down. I never said he could come. Not here. The Aerie is impregnable, Mother said.
Your mother is dead, my lord. Until your 16th name day, I rule the Aerie.
Peter turned to the stoop-back serving woman, hovering near the kitchen steps.
Miller, fetch his lordship a new spoon. He wants to eat his porridge.
I do not let my porridge fly.
This time Robert flung the bowl, porridge and honey, and all. Peter Baelish ducked aside nimbly, but Maester Coleman was not so quick. The wooden bowl caught him square in the chest, and its contents exploded upward over his face and shoulders. He yelped in a most unmaester-like fashion, whilst Elaine turned to soothe the little lording, but too late. The fit was on him. A pitcher of milk went flying as his hand caught it, flailing. When he tried to rise, he knocked his chair backwards and fell on top of it. One foot caught Elaine in the belly, so hard it knocked the wind out of her. "Oh, gods, be good," she heard Peter say, disgusted. Globs of porridge dotted Maester Coleman's face and hair as he knelt over his charge, murmuring soothing words. One gobbet crept slowly down his right cheek, like a lumpy grey-brown tear.
"It is not so bad a spell as the last one,"
Elaine thought, trying to be hopeful. By the time the shaking stopped, two guards in sky-blue cloaks and silvery mail shirts had come at Peter's summons. "Take him back to bed and leech him," the Lord Protector said, and the taller guardsman scooped the boy up in his arms. "I could carry him myself," Elaine thought. "He's no heavier than a doll." Coleman lingered a moment before following.
My lord, this parley might best be left for another day. His lordship's spells have grown worse since Lady Lysa's death, more frequent and more violent. I bleed the child as often as I dare and mix him dream wine and milk of the poppy to help him sleep. But
he sleeps 12 hours a day, Peter said. I require him awake from time to time.
The maester combed his fingers through his hair, dribbling globs of porridge on the floor.
Lady Lysa would give his lordship her breast whenever he grew overwrought. Archmaester Ebrose claims that mother's milk has many healthful properties.
Is that your counsel, maester, that we find a wet nurse for the Lord of the Airy and Defender of the Vale?
When should we wean him? On his wedding day? That way he can move directly from the nurse's nipple to his wife's.
Lord Peter's laugh made it plain what he thought of that.
No, I think not. I suggest you find another way. The boy is fond of sweets, is he not?
Sweets, said Coleman.
Sweets. Cakes and pies, jams and jellies, honey on the comb, perhaps a pinch of sweet sleep in his milk. Have you tried that? Just a pinch to calm him and stop his wretched shaking.
A pinch.
The apple in the maester's throat moved up and down as he swallowed.
One small pinch. Perhaps. Not too much, not too often. Yes, I might try. A pinch,
Lord Peter said.
Before you bring him forth to meet the lords.
As you command, my lord.
The maester hurried out, his chain clinking softly with every step. Father, Elaine asked when he was gone, will you have a bowl of porridge to break your fast?
I despise porridge.
He looked at her with little finger's eyes.
I'd sooner break my fast with a kiss.
A true daughter would not refuse her sire a kiss. So Elaine went to him and kissed him, a quick dry peck upon the cheek, and just as quickly stepped away.
How dutiful!
Littlefinger smiled with his mouth, but not his eyes.
Well, I have other duties for you, as it happens. Tell the cook to mull some red wine with honey and raisins. Our guests will be cold and thirsty after their long climb. You are to meet them when they arrive and offer them refreshment. Wine, bread and cheese. What sort of cheese is left to us?
The sharp white and the stinky blue.
The white.
and you'd best change as well. Elaine looked down at her dress, the deep blue and rich dark red of Riveron.
Is it too?
It is too tully. The Lord's Declarant will not be pleased by the sight of my bastard daughter prancing about in my dead wife's clothes. Choose something else. Need I remind you to avoid sky blue and cream?
No.
Sky blue and cream were the colours of House Aaron.
Eight, you said. Bronzion is one of them?
The only one who matters.
Bronzion knows me, she reminded him. He was a guest at Winterfell when his son rode north to take the Black. She had fallen wildly in love with Sir Waymar, she remembered dimly,
but that was a lifetime ago, when she was a stupid little girl.
And that was not the only time Lord Roy saw. He saw Sansa Stark again at King's Landing during the Hand's tourney.
Peter put his finger under his chin.
That Royce glimpsed this pretty face, I do not doubt, but it was one face in a thousand. A man fighting in a tourney has more to concern himself than some child in a crowd. And at Winterfell, Sansa was a little girl with auburn hair. My daughter is a maiden, tall and fair, and her hair is chestnut. Men see what they expect to see, Elaine.
He kissed her nose.
Have Maddy lay a fire in the solar. I shall receive our Lord's Declarant there.
Not the High Hall?
No. Gods forbid they glimpse me near the high seat of the Aarons. They might think I mean to sit in it. Cheeks born so low as mine must never aspire to such lofty cushions.
The solar?
She should have stopped with that, but the words came tumbling out of her.
If you gave them Robert.
And the veil?
They have the veil.
Oh, much of it, that's true. Not all, however. I'm well loved in Gulltown, and have some lordly friends of mine own as well. Grafton, Linderly, Lionel Corbury, though I grant you they're no match for the Lord's Declarant. Still, where would you have us go, Elaine? Back to my mighty stronghold on the Fingers?
She had thought about that.
Joffrey gave you Harrenhal. You are lord in your own right there.
By title? I need a great seat to marry Lysa, and the Lannisters were not about to grant me Casterly Rock.
Yes, but the castle is yours.
Ah, and what a castle it is! Cavernous halls and ruined towers, ghosts and draughts, ruinous to heat, impossible to garrison, and there's that small matter of a curse.
Curses are only in songs and stories.
That seemed to amuse him.
Has someone made a song about Gregor Clegane dying of a poisoned spear thrust? Or about the sellswords before him, whose limbs Sir Gregor removed a joint at a time? That one took the castle from Sir Aimery Loch, who received it from Lord Tywin. A bear killed one, your dwarf the other. Lady Wentz died as well, I hear. Luston, Strongs, Harroways, Harrenhal has withered every hand to touch it.
Then give it to Lord Frey.
Peter laughed.
Perhaps I shall, or better still, to our sweet Cersei. Though I should not speak harshly of her, she is sending me some splendid tapestries. Isn't that kind of her?
The mention of the Queen's name made her stiffen.
She's not kind, she scares me. If she should learn where I am...
I might have to remove her from the game sooner than I'd planned. Providing she does not remove herself first.
Peter teased her with a little smile.
In the Game of Thrones, even the humblest pieces can have wills of their own. Sometimes they refuse to make the moves you plan for them. Mark that well, Elaine. It's a lesson that Cersei Lannister still has yet to learn. Now, don't you have some duties to perform?
She did indeed. She saw to the mulling of the wine first, found a suitable wheel of sharp white cheese, and commanded the cook to bake bread enough for 20, in case the Lord's Declarant brought more men than expected.
Once they eat our bread and salt, they are our guests and cannot harm us.
The Freyers had broken all the laws of hospitality when they had murdered her lady mother and her brother at the Twins. But she could not believe that a lord as noble as Yon Royce would ever stoop to do the same. The solar next. Its floor was covered by a Moorish carpet, so there was no need to lay down rushes. Elaine asked two serving men to erect the trestle table and bring up 8 of the heavy oak and leather chairs. For a feast, she would have placed 1 at the head of the table, 1 at the foot, and 3 along each side, but this was no feast. She had the men arrange 6 chairs on one side of the table, 2 on the other. By now the Lord's declarant might have climbed as far as snow. It took most of the day to make the climb, even on muleback. Afoot, most men took several days. It might be that the lords would talk late into the night. They would need fresh candles. After Maddie laid the fire, she sent her down to find the scented beeswax candles Lord Waxley had given Lady Lysa when he sought to win her hand. Then she visited the kitchens once again, to make certain of the wine and bread. All seemed well in hand, and there was still time enough for her to bathe and wash her hair and change. There was a gown of purple silk that gave her pause, and another of dark blue velvet, slashed with silver, that would have woken all the colour in her eyes. But in the end she remembered that Elaine was after all a bastard, and must not presume to dress above her station. The dress she picked was lamb's wool, dark brown and simply cut, with leaves and vines embroidered around the bodice, sleeves, and hem in golden thread. It was modest and becoming, though scarce richer than something a servant girl might wear. Peter had given her all of Lady Lysa's jewels as well, and she tried on several necklaces, but they all seemed ostentatious. In the end she chose a simple velvet ribbon in autumn gold. When Gretchel fetched her Lysa's silvered looking-glass, the colour seemed just perfect with Elaine's mass of dark brown hair. "Lord Royce will never know me," she thought. "Why, I hardly know myself." Feeling near as bold as Peter Baelish, Elaine Stone donned her smile and went down to meet their guests. The area was the only castle in the 7 kingdoms where the main entrance was underneath the dungeons. Steep stone steps crept up the mountainside past the Way Castle, stone and snow, but they came to an end at sky. The final 600 feet of the ascent were vertical, forcing would-be visitors to dismount their mules and make a choice. They could ride the swaying wooden basket that was used to lift supplies, or clamber up a rocky chimney using handholds carved into the rock. Lord Redfort and Lady Wainwood, the most elderly of the Lord's declarant, chose to be drawn up by the winch, after which the basket was lowered once more for fat Lord Belmore. The other lords made the climb. Elaine met them in the crescent chamber beside a warming fire, where she welcomed them in Lord Robert's name, and served them bread and cheese and cups of hot-mulled wine in silver cups. Peter had given her a roll of arms to study, so she knew their heraldry, if not their faces. The Red Castle was Red Fort, plainly. A short man with a neat grey beard and mild eyes. Lady Anya was the only woman amongst the lords declarant, and wore a deep green mantle with the broken wheel of Wainwood picked out in beads of jet. 6 silver bells on purple, that was Belmore, pear-bellied and round of shoulder. His beard was a ginger-grey horror, sprouting from a multiplicity of chins. Simon Templeton's, by contrast, was black and sharply pointed. A beak of a nose and icy blue eyes made the Knight of 9 Stars look like some elegant bird of prey. His doublet displayed 9 black stars within a golden saltire. Young Lord Hunter's ermine cloak confused her till she spied the brooch that pinned it. 5 silver arrows fanned. Elaine would have put his age closer to 50 than to 40. His father had ruled at Longbow Hall for nigh on 60 years, only to die so abruptly that some whispered the new lord had hastened his inheritance. Hunter's cheeks and nose were red as apples, which bespoke a certain fondness for the grape. She made certain to fill his cup as often as he emptied it. The youngest man in the party had three ravens on his chest, each clutching a blood-red heart in its talons. His brown hair was shoulder-length. One stray lock curled down across his forehead.
Sir Lynn Corbray,
Elaine thought, with a wary glance at his hard mouth and restless eyes. Last of all came the Royces, Lord Nestor and Bronze Yon. The Lord of Runestone stood as tall as the hound. Though his hair was grey and his face lined, Lord Yon still looked as though he could break most younger men like twigs in those huge, gnarled hands. His seamed and solemn face brought back all of Sansa's memories of his time at Winterfell. She remembered him at table, speaking quietly with her mother. She heard his voice booming off the walls when he rode back from the hunt with a buck behind his saddle. She could see him in the yard, a practice sword in hand, hammering her father to the ground and turning to defeat Sir Roderick as well.
He will know me. How could he not?
She considered throwing herself at his feet to beg for his protection.
He never fought for Rob. Why should he fight for me? The war is finished, and Winterfell has fallen.
Lord Royce, she asked timidly, will you have a cup of wine to take the chill off?
Bronze John had slate-grey eyes, half hidden beneath the bushiest eyebrows she had ever seen. They crinkled when he looked down at her.
Do I know you, girl?
Elaine felt as though she had swallowed her tongue, but Lord Nestor rescued her.
Elaine is the Lord Protector's natural daughter,
he told his cousin gruffly.
Littlefinger's Littlefinger
has been busy, said Lynn Corbury, with a wicked smile. Belmore laughed, and Elaine could feel the colour rising in her cheeks.
How old are you, child?
Asked Lady Waynewood.
4 and 14, my lady.
For a moment she had forgotten how old Elaine should be.
And I'm no child, but a maiden flowered.
But not deflowered, one can hope.
Young Lord Hunter's bushy moustache hid his mouth entirely.
Yet,
said Lynn Corbury, as if she were not there.
But ripe for plucking soon, I'd say.
Is that what passes for courtesy at heart's home?
Anya Waynewood's hair was greying, and she had crow's feet round her eyes and loose skin beneath her chin. But there was no mistaking the air of nobility about her.
The girl is young and gently bred, and has suffered enough horrors. Mind your tongue, sir.
My tongue is my concern, Corbury replied.
Your ladyship should take care to mind her own. I've never taken kindly to chastisement, as any number of dead men could tell you.
Lady Waynewood turned away from him.
Best take us to your father, Elaine. The sooner we are done with this, the better.
The Lord Protector awaits you in the solar, if my lords would follow me. From the crescent chamber they climbed a steep flight of marble steps that bypassed both undercrofts and dungeons and passed beneath three murder holes, which the Lord's declarant pretended not to notice. Belmore was soon puffing like a bellows, and Redford's face turned as grey as his hair. The guards atop the stairs raised the portcullis at their coming.
This way, if you please, my lords.
Elaine led them down the arcade past a dozen splendid tapestries. Sir Lothar Brune stood outside the solar. He opened the door for them and followed them inside. Peter was seated at the trestle table, with a cup of wine to hand, looking over a crisp white parchment. He glanced up as the Lord's declarant filed in.
My lords, be welcome. And you as well, my lady. The ascent is wearisome, I know. Please be seated. Elaine, my sweet, more wine for a noble guest.
As you say, father.
The candles had been lighted, she was pleased to see. The solar smelled of nutmeg and other costly spices. She went to fetch the flagon, whilst the visitors arranged themselves side by side, all save Nestor Royce, who hesitated before walking around the table to take the empty chair beside Lord Peter and Lynn Corbury, who went to stand beside the hearth instead. The heart-shaped ruby in the pommel of his sword shone redly as he warmed his hands. Elaine saw him smile at Sir Lothar Broom.
"Sir Lynn is very handsome for an older man," she thought, "but I do not like the way he smiles."
"I have been reading this remarkable declaration of yours," Peter began. "Splendid. Whatever Maester wrote this as a gift for words, I only wish you had invited me to sign as well."
That took them unawares.
"You?" said Belmore. "Sign? I will, De Quille, as well as any man, and no one loves Lord Robert more than I do. As for these false friends and evil counsellors, by all means, let us root them out. My lords, I am with you, heart and hand. Show me where to sign, I beg you."
Elaine, poring, heard Lynn Corbray chuckle. The others seemed at a loss, till Bronze Yon Royce cracked his knuckles and said,
"We do not come for your signature, nor do we mean to bandy words with you, little finger."
"What a pity, I do so love a nicely banded word." Peter set the parchment to one side.
"As you wish, let us be blunt. What would you have of me, my lords and ladies?"
We will have naught of you."
Simon Templeton fixed the Lord Protector with his cold blue stare.
"We will have you gone."
"Gone?"
Peter feigned surprise. "Where would I go?"
"The crown has made you Lord of Harrenhal,"
young Lord Hunter pointed out.
"That should be enough for any man."
"The Riverlands have need of a lord,"
old Horton Redford said.
"River Run stands besieged. Bracken and Blackwood are at open war, and outlaws roam freely on both sides of the Trident, stealing and killing as they will. Unburied corpses litter the landscape everywhere you go."
"You make it sound so wonderfully attractive, Lord Redford,"
Peter answered.
"But as it happens, I have present duties here, and there is Lord Robert to consider. Would you have me drag a sickly child into the midst of such carnage?"
"His lordship will remain in the Vale," declared Jan Royce.
"I mean to take the boy with me to Runestone, and raise him up to be a knight that John Aaron would be proud of."
"Why Runestone?" Peter mused. "Why not Arnoaks or the Red Fort? Why not Longbow Hall?"
"Any of these would serve as well," declared Lord Belmore, "and his lordship will visit each in turn in due time."
"Will he?"
Peter's tone seemed to hint at doubts.
Lady Waynewood sighed.
Lord Peter, if you think to set us one against the other, you may spare yourself the effort. We speak with one voice here. Runestone suits us all. Lord Yon raised 3 fine sons of his own. There is no man more fit to foster his young lordship. Maester Heriwig is a good deal older and more experienced than your own Maester Coleman, and better suited to treat Lord Robert's frailties. In Runestone, the boy will learn the arts of war from strong Sam Stone. No man could hope for a finer master-at-arms. Septon Lucas will instruct him in the matters of the spirit. At Runestone he will also find other boys his own age, more suitable companions than the old women and sellswords that presently surround him."
Peter Baelish fingered his beard. "His lordship needs companions. I do not disagree. Elaine is hardly an old woman, though. Lord Robert loves my daughter dearly. He will be glad to tell you so himself. And as it happens, I have asked Lord Grafton and Lord Linderley to send me each a son to ward, each of them as a boy of an age with Robert."
Lynn Corbury laughed.
2 pops from a pair of lapdogs.
"Robert should have an older boy about him, too. A promising young squire, say. Someone he could admire and try to emulate."
Peter turned to Lady Waynewood.
"You have such a boy at Arnoaks, my lady. Perhaps you might agree to send me Harold Harding."
Anya Waynewood seemed amused.
"Lord Petrie, you are as bold a thief as I'd ever care to meet."
"I do not wish to steal the boy," said Peter.
but he and Lord Robert should be friends. Bronze Jan Royce leaned forward.
It is meet and proper that Lord Robert should befriend young Harry, and he shall, at Runestone under my care, as my ward and squire. Give us the boy, said Lord Belmore, and you may depart the vale unmolested for your proper seat at Harrenhal.
Peter gave him a look of mild reproach.
Are you suggesting that elsewise I might come to harm, my lord? I cannot think why. My late wife seemed to think this was my proper seat.
Lord Baelish, Lady Wainwood said, Lysa Tully was John Aaron's widow and the mother of his child, and ruled here as his regent. You, let's be frank, you are no Aaron, and Lord Robert is no blood of yours. By what right do you presume to rule us?
Lysa named me Lord Protector, I do seem to recall. Young Lord Hunter said,
Lysa Tully was never truly of the Vale, nor had she the right to dispose of us.
And Lord Robert, Peter asked, will your lordship also claim that Lady Lysa had no right to dispose of her own son? Nestor Royce had been silent all this while, but now he spoke up loudly.
I once hoped to wed Lady Lysa myself, as did Lord Hunter's father and Lady Anya's son. Corbray scarce left her side for half a year. Had she chosen any one of us, no man here would dispute his right to be the Lord Protector. It happens that she chose Lord Littlefinger, and entrusted her son to his care.
He was John Aaron's son as well, cousin, Bronze John said, frowning at the keeper. He belongs to the Vale.
Peter feigned puzzlement. The Airy is as much a part of the Vale as Runestone. Unless someone has moved it.
Cheap all you like, Littlefinger,
Lord Belmore blustered.
The boy shall come with us.
I am loath to disappoint you, Lord Belmore, but my stepson will be remaining here with me. He's not a robust child, as all of you well know. The journey would tax him sorely. As his stepfather and Lord Protector, I cannot permit it. Simon Templeton cleared his throat and said,
Each of us has 1,000 men at the foot of this mountain, Littlefinger. What a splendid place for them. If need be, we can summon many more.
Are you threatening me with war, sir? Peter did not sound the least afraid. Bronze Jan said,
We shall have Lord Robert.
For a moment it seemed as though they had come to an impasse, until Lynn Corbury turned from the fire. All this talk makes me ill. Littlefinger will talk you out of your small clothes if you listen long enough. The only way to settle his sort is with steel. He drew his longsword. Peter spread his hands.
I wear no sword, sir.
Easily remedied. Candlelight rippled along the smoke-grey steel of Corbury's blade, so dark that it put Sansa in mind of ice. Her father's greatsword.
Your apple eater holds a blade. Tell him to give it to you.
Or draw that dagger. She saw Lothar Brun reach for his own sword, but before the blades could meet, Bronze Jan rose in wrath.
Put up your steel, sir. Are you a Corbury or a Frey? We are guests here.
Lady Wainwood pursed her lips and said,
This is unseemly. Sheathe your sword, Corbury,
young Lord Hunter echoed.
You shame us all with this.
Come, Lynn, chided Redfort in a softer tone. This will serve for naught. Put Lady Forlorn to bed.
My lady has a thirst, Sir Lynn insisted. Whenever she comes out to dance, she likes a drop of red.
Your lady must go thirsty,
Bronze Jan put himself squarely in Corbury's path.
Oh, the Lord's declarant, Lynn Corby snorted. You should have named yourself the Six Old Women.
He slid the dark sword back into a scabbard and left them, shouldering Brune aside as if he were not there. Elaine listened to his footsteps recede. Anya Wainwood and Horton Redford exchanged a look. Hunter drained his wine cup and held it out to be refilled.
Lord Baelish, Sir Simon said, you must forgive us that display.
Must I? Littlefinger's voice had grown cold. You brought him here, my lords. Bronzion said,
it was never our intent.
You brought him here. I would be well within my rights to call my guards and have all of you arrested.
Hunter lurched to his feet so wildly that he almost knocked the flagon out of Elaine's hands.
You gave us safe conduct.
Yes.
Be grateful that I have more honour than some.
Peter sounded as angry as she'd ever heard him.
I have read your declaration and heard your demands. Now hear mine. Remove your armies from this mountain. Go home and leave my son in peace. Misrule there has been. I will not deny it. But that was Lysa's work, not mine. Grant me but a year, and with Lord Nestor's help, I promise that none of you shall have any cause for grievance.
So you see, said Belmore.
Yet how shall we trust you?
You dare call me untrustworthy?
It was not me who bared Steeleth of Parley. You're right of defending Lord Robert, even as you deny him food. That must end. I'm no warrior, but I will fight you if you do not lift the siege. There are other lords besides you in the Vale, and King's Landing will send men as well. If it is war you want, say so now, and the Vale will bleed.
Elaine could see the doubt blooming in the eyes of the lord's declarant.
A year is not so long a time, Lord Redford said uncertainly. Mayhap, sir, if you gave assurances.
None of us wants war, acknowledged Lady Waynewood. Autumn wanes, and we must gird ourselves for winter.
Belmore cleared his throat.
At the end of this year, if I have not set the Vale to rights, I shall willingly step down as Lord Protector.
Peter promised them.
I call that more than fair,
Lord Nestor Royce put in.
There must be no reprisals, insisted Templeton. No talk of treason or rebellion. You must swear to that as well.
Gladly, said Peter.
It is friends I want, not foes. I shall pardon all of you, in writing if you wish. Even Lind Corbury. His brother is a good man. There's no need to bring down shame upon a noble house.
Lady Waynewood turned to her fellow lord's declarant.
My lords, perhaps we might confer.
There is no need. It's plain that he has won.
Bronzion's grey eyes considered Peter Baelish.
I like it not, but it would seem you have your year. Best use it well, my lord. Not all of us are fooled.
He opened the door so forcefully that he all but wrenched it off its hinges. Later there was a feast of sorts, though Peter was forced to make apologies for the humble fare. Robert was trotted out in a doublet of cream and blue and played the little lord quite graciously. Bronzion was not there to see. He had already departed from the Eyrie to begin the long descent, as had Sir Lynn Corbury before him. The other lords remained with them till morn.
He bewitched them,
Elaine thought, as she lay abed that night, listening to the wind howl outside her windows. She could not have said where the suspicion came from, but once it crossed her mind, it would not let her sleep. She tossed and turned, worrying at it like a dog at some old bone. Finally she rose and dressed herself, leaving Gretchel to her dreams. Peter was still awake, scratching out a letter.
Elaine, he said, my sweet, what brings you here so late?
I had to know. What will happen in a year? He put down his quill.
Redfort and Waynewood are old. One or both of them may die. Gilwood Hunter will be murdered by his brothers, most likely by young Harlan, who arranged Lord Ian's death. In for a penny, in for a stag, I always say. Belmore is corrupt and can be bought. Templeton I shall befriend. Bronzion Royce will continue to be hostile, I fear. But so long as he stands alone,
is not so much a threat.
And Selene Corbray?
The candlelight was dancing in his eyes. Selene will remain my implacable enemy. He will speak of me with scorn and loathing to every man he meets, and lend his sword to every secret plot to bring me down.
That was when her suspicion turned to certainty.
And how shall you reward him for this service?
Littlefinger laughed aloud.
With gold, and boys, and promises, of course. Selene is a man of simple taste, my sweetling. All he likes is gold, and boys, and killing.
Cersei. The king was pouting.
I want to sit on the Iron Throne, he told her. You always let Joff sit up there.
But Joff was 12.
But I'm the king. The throne belongs to me.
Oh, who told you that? Cersei took a deep breath, so Dorcas could lace her up more tightly. She was a big girl, much stronger than Sunil, though clumsier as well. Tommen's face turned red.
No one told me.
No one? Is that what you call your lady wife? The queen could smell Marjorie Tyrell all over this rebellion. If you lie to me, I will have no choice but to send for Pate and have him beaten till he bleeds. Pate was Tommen's whipping boy, as he had been Geoffrey's. Is that what you want?
No,
the king muttered sullenly. Who told you? He shuffled his feet.
Lady Marjorie.
He knew better than to call her queen in his mother's hearing. That is better, Tommen. I have grave matters to decide, matters that you are far too young to understand. I do not need a silly little boy fidgeting on the throne behind me and distracting me with childish questions. I suppose Marjorie thinks you ought to be at my council meetings, too.
Yes,
he admitted.
She says I have to learn to be king.
When you are older, you can attend as many councils as you wish, Cersei told him. I promise you, you will soon grow sick of them. Robert used to doze through the sessions. When he troubled to attend at all, he preferred to hunt and hawk and leave the tedium to old Lord Arryn. Do you remember him?
He died of a bellyache.
So he did, poor man. As you are so eager to learn, perhaps you should learn the names of all the kings of Westeros, and the hands who served them. You may recite them to me on the morrow.
Yes, mother,
he said meekly. That's my good boy. The rule was hers. Cersei did not mean to give it up until Tommen came of age. I waited. So can he. I waited half my life. She had played the dutiful daughter, the blushing bride, the pliant wife. She had suffered Robert's drunken groping, Jamie's jealousy, Renly's mockery, Varys with his titters, Stannis endlessly grinding his teeth. She had contended with John Arryn, Ned Stark, and her vile, treacherous, murderous dwarf brother, all the while promising herself that one day it would be her turn. If Marjorie Tyrell thinks to cheat me of my hour in the sun, she had bloody well think again. Still, it was an ill way to break her fast, and Cersei's day did not soon improve. She spent the rest of the morning with Lord Giles and his ledger books, listening to him cough about stars and stags and dragons. After him, Lord Waters arrived to report that the first three Drummonds were near completion, and begged for more gold to finish them in the splendour they deserved. The Queen was pleased to grant him his request. Moonboy capered as she took her midday meal with members of the merchant guilds and listened to them complain about sparrows wandering the streets and sleeping in the squares. I may need to use the gold cloaks to chase these sparrows from the city, she was thinking, when Pycelle intruded. The Grand Maester had been especially querulous in council of late. At the last session he had complained bitterly about the men that Oran Waters had chosen to captain her new Drummonds. Waters meant to give the ships to younger men,
whilst Pycelle argued for experience, insisting that the command should go to those captains who had survived the fires of the Blackwater. "Seasoned men of proven loyalty," he called them. Cersei called them old, and sided with Lord Waters. "The only thing these captains proved was that they know how to swim," she'd said. "No mother should outlive her children, and no captain should outlive his ship." Pycelle had taken the rebuke with ill grace. He seemed less choleric today, and even managed a sort of tremulous smile. "Your Grace, glad tidings," he announced. "Wyman Manderley has done as you commanded, and beheaded Lord Stannis's Onion Knight." "We know this for a certainty. The man's head and hands have been mounted above the walls of White Harbour. Lord Wyman avows this, and the Freys confirm. They have seen the head there with an onion in its mouth, and the hands, one marked by his shortened fingers." "Very good," said Cersei. "Send a bird to Manderley and inform him that his son will be returned forthwith, now that he has demonstrated his loyalty." White Harbour would soon return to the King's peace, and Roose Bolton and his bastard son were closing in on Moat Caelan, from south and north. Once the moat was theirs, they would join their strength and clear the ironmen out of Torren Square and Deepwood Mott as well. That should win them the allegiance of Ned Stark's remaining bannermen when the time came to march against Lord Stannis. To the south, meanwhile, Mace Tyrell had raised a city of tents outside Storm's End, and had 2 dozen mangonels flinging stones against the castle's massive walls. Thus far, to small effect. "Lord Tyrell the Warrior," the Queen mused. "His sigil ought to be a fat man sitting on his ass." That afternoon, the Dour Bravassi envoy turned up for his audience. Cersei had put him off for a fortnight, and would have gladly put him off another year. But Lord Giles claimed he could no longer deal with the man, though the Queen was starting to wonder if Giles was capable of doing anything but coughing. "Noho Demetus," the Bravassi named himself. An irritating name for an irritating man. His voice was irritating, too. Cersei shifted in her seat as he went on, wondering how long she must endure his hectoring. Behind her loomed the Iron Throne, its barbs and blades throwing twisted shadows across the floor. Only the king or his hand could sit upon the throne itself. Cersei sat by its foot, in a seat of gilded wood piled with crimson cushions. When the Bravassi paused for breath, she saw her chance. "This is more properly a matter for our Lord Treasurer." That answer did not please a noble Noho, it would seem.
"I have spoken with Lord Giles of 6 times. He coughs at me and makes excuses, Your Grace. But the gold is not forthcoming."
"Speak to him 7th time, Cersei suggested pleasantly. "The number 7 is sacred to our gods."
"It pleases Your Grace to make a jest, eh? I see."
"When I make a jest, I smile. Do you see me smiling? Do you hear laughter? I assure you, when I make a jest, men laughed.
King Robert is dead,"
she said sharply. "The Iron Bank will have its gold when this rebellion has been put down." He had the insolence to scowl at her.
"Your Grace, this audience is at an end."
Cersei had suffered quite enough for one day. "Sir Meryn, show this noble Noho Demetus to the door. Sir Osmond, you may escort me back to my apartments." Her guests would soon arrive, and she had to bathe and change. Supper promised to be a tedious affair as well. It was hard work to rule a kingdom, much less 7 of them. Sir Osmond Kettleback fell in beside her on the steps, tall and lean, in his Kingsguard whites. When Cersei was certain they were quite alone, she slid her arm through his. "How is your little brother faring, pray?" Sir Osmond looked uneasy.
Well, enough, only...
"Only?" The Queen let a hint of anger edge her words. I must confess I am running short of patience with dear Osney. It is past time he broke in that little filly. I named him Tommen Swornsword, so he could spend part of every day in Marjorie's company. He should have plucked the rose by now. Is the little queen blind to his charms?
Oh, his charms is fine. He's a kettle black, ain't he?
Begging your pardon? Sir Osmond ran his fingers through his oily black hair.
It's her that's the trouble.
And why is that? The queen had begun to nurse doubts about Sir Osney. Perhaps another man would have been more to Marjorie's liking. Or Rain Waters with that silvery hair. Or a big strapping fellow like Sir Tallard. Would the maid prefer someone else? Does your brother's face displease her?
Oh, she likes his face. She touched his scars 2 days ago, he told me. What woman gave you these? She asked. Osney never said it was a woman, but she knew. Might be someone told her. She's always touching him when they talk, he says, straightening the clasp on his cloak, brushing back his hair, and like that. One time, at the archery butt, she had him show her how to hold a longbow, so he had to put his arms around her. Osney tells her, bawdy jests, and she laughs and comes back with ones that are even bawdier. Oh, she wants him, that's plain, but...
But, Cersei prompted,
they are never alone. The king's with them most all the time, and when he's not, there's someone else. Two of her ladies share her bed, different ones every night. Two others bring her breakfast and help her dress. She prays with her scepter, reads with her cousin Eleanor, sings with her cousin Alla, sews with her cousin Megger. When she's not off hawking with Janner Fussaway and Mary Crane, she's playing Come Into My Castle with that little Bulwer girl. She never goes riding, but she takes a tail. 4 or 5 companions and 12 guards at least, and there's always men about her, even in the maiden vault.
Men? That was something. That had possibilities. What men are these, pray tell?
Sir Osmond shrugged. Singers. She's a fool for singers and jugglers and such. Knights come round to moon over her cousins. Sir Tallad's the worst, Osney says. That big oaf don't seem to know if it's Eleanor or Arla he wants, but he knows he wants her awful bad. The Redwyn twins come calling too. Slubber brings flowers and fruit, and Horror's taken up the lute. To hear Osney tell it, you can make a sweeter sound strangling a cat. The Summer Islanders always underfoot as well.
Jalamazo, Cersei gave a derisive snort. Begging her for gold and swords to win his homeland back, most like. Beneath his jewels and feathers, Zo was little more than a well-born beggar. Robert could have put an end to his importuning for good with one firm no, but the notion of conquering the Summer Isles had appealed to her drunken lout of a husband. No doubt he dreamed of brown-skinned wenches naked beneath feathered cloaks with nipples black as coal. So instead of no, Robert always told Zo next year, though somehow next year never came.
"'I couldn't say if he was begging, Your Grace,' Sir Osmond answered. "'Osney says he's teaching them the summer tongue, not Osney, the filly and her cousins.
A horse that speaks the summer tongue would make a great sensation,' the Queen said dryly. "'Tell your brother to keep his spurs well honed.' I shall find some way for him to mount his filly soon. He may rely on that.
I'll tell him, Your Grace. He's eager for that ride. Don't think he ain't. Oh, she's a pretty little thing, that filly.
It is me he's eager for, fool, the Queen thought. All he wants of Marjorie is the lordship between her legs. As fond as she was of Osmond, at times he seemed as slow as Robert. I hope his sword is quicker than his wits. The day may come that Tommen has some need of it. They were crossing beneath the shadow of the broken Tower of the Hand, when the sound of cheers swept over them. Across the yard some squire had made a pass at the quintain and sent the cross-arm spinning. The cheers were being led by Marjorie Tyrell and her hens. A lot of uproar for very little. You would think the boy had won a tourney. Then she was startled to see that it was Tommen on the courser, clad all in gilded plate. The queen had little choice but to don a smile and go to see her son. She reached him as the knight of flowers was helping him from his horse. The boy was breathless with excitement.
"Did you see?" he was asking everyone. "I did it just the way Sir Loras said. Did you see, Sir Osney?"
"I did," said Osney Kettleblack. "A pretty sight."
"You have a better seat than me, sire," put in Sir Dermot.
"I broke the lance, too, Sir Loras. Did you hear it?"
"As loud as a crack of thunder."
A rose of jade and gold clasped Sir Loras's white cloak at the shoulder, and the wind was riffling artfully through his brown locks.
"You rode a splendid course, but once is not enough. You must do it again upon the morrow. You must ride every day, until every blow lands true and straight, and your lance is as much a part of you as your arm."
"I want to." "You were glorious."
Marjorie went to one knee, kissed the king upon his cheek, and put an arm around him.
"Brother, take care," she warned Loras. "My gallant husband will be unhorsing you in a few more years, I think."
Her three cousins all agreed, and the wretched little Bulwer girl began to hop about, chanting, "Tommen will be the champion, the champion, the champion." "When he is a man grown," said Cersei. Their smiles withered like roses kissed by frost. The puck-faced old scepter was the first to bend her knee. The rest followed, save for the little queen and her brother. Tommen did not seem to notice the sudden chill in the air.
"Mother, did you see me?" he burbled happily. "I broke my lance on the shield, and the bag never hit me."
"I was watching you from across the yard. You did very well, Tommen. I would expect no less of you. Justing is in your blood. One day you shall rule the lists as your father did."
"No man will stand before him."
Marjorie Tyrell gave the queen a coy smile.
"But I never knew that King Robert was so accomplished at the jousts. Pray tell us, Your Grace, what tourneys did he win? What great knights did he unseat? I know the king should like to hear about his father's victories."
A flush crept up Cersei's neck. The girl had caught her out. Robert Baratheon had been an indifferent jouster, in truth. During tourneys he had much preferred the melee, where he could beat men bloody with blunted axe or hammer. It had been Jaime she had been thinking of when she spoke. "It's not like me to forget myself." "Robert won the tourney of the Trident," she had to say. "He overthrew Prince Rhaegar and named me his queen of love and beauty. I'm surprised you do not know that story, good daughter." She gave Marjorie no time to frame a reply. "Sir Osmond, help my son from his armor, if you would be so good. Sir Loras, walk with me. I need a word with you." The Knight of Flowers had no recourse but to follow at her heels, like the puppy he was. Cersei waited until they were on the serpentine steps before she said, "Whose notion was that, pray?"
"My sister's," he admitted.
"Sir Tallard, Sir Dermot, and Sir Portifer were riding at the Quintain, and the Queen suggested that His Grace might like to have a turn. He calls her that to irk me." "And your part?" "I helped His Grace to don his armor and showed him how to couch his lance," he answered. The horse was much too large for him. What if he had fallen off? What if the sandbag had smashed his head in? "Bruises and bloody lips are all part of being a knight. I begin to understand why your brother is a cripple." That wiped the smile off his pretty face, she was pleased to see. "Perhaps my brother failed to explain your duties to you, sir. You are here to protect my son from his enemies. Training him for knighthood is the province of the Master-at-Arms. The Red Keep has had no Master-at-Arms since Aaron Santigar was slain," Sir Loras said, with a hint of reproach in his voice. "His Grace is almost 9 and eager to learn. At his age, he should be a squire. Someone has to teach him." "Someone will, but it will not be you. Pray, who did you squire for, sir?" she asked sweetly. "Lord Renly, was it not?"
"I had that honour,"
Yes, I thought as much. Cersei had seen how tight the bonds grew between squires and the knights they served. She did not want Tommen growing close to Loras Tyrell. The Knight of Flowers was no sort of man for any boy to emulate. I have been remiss. With a realm to rule, a war to fight, and a father to mourn, somehow I overlooked the crucial matter of naming a new master at arms. I shall rectify that error at once. Sir Loras pushed back a brown curl that had fallen across his forehead. Your Grace will not find any man half so skilled with sword and lance as I. Oh, humble, aren't we? Tommen is your king, not your squire. You are to fight for him and die for him if need be. No more. She left him on the drawbridge that spanned the dry moat with its bed of iron spikes, and entered Maegar's holdfast alone. Where am I to find a master at arms? She wondered as she climbed to her apartments. Having refused Sir Loras, she dare not turn to any of the Kingsguard's knights. That would be salt in the wound, certainly to anger Highgarden. Sir Tanard? Sir Dermot? There must be someone. Tommen was growing fond of his new sworn shield. But Osnir was proving himself less capable than she had hoped in the matter of Maid Margaery, and she had a different office in mind for his brother Osfrid. It was rather a pity that the hound had gone rabid. Tommen had always been frightened at Sandor Clegane's harsh voice and burned face, and Clegane's scorn would have been the perfect antidote to Loras Tyrell's simpering chivalry. Aron Sentigar was Dornish, Cersei recalled. I could send to Dorne. Centuries of blood and war lay between Sunspear and Highgarden. Yes, a Dornishman might suit my needs admirably. There must be some good swords in Dorne. When she entered her solar, Cersei found Lord Qyburn reading in a window seat.
If it please your Grace, I have reports.
More plots and treasons? Cersei asked. I have had a long and tiring day. Tell me quickly. He smiled sympathetically.
As you wish. There is talk that the Archon of Tyrosh has offered terms to Lys to end their present trade war. It had been rumored that Myr was about to enter the war on the Tyroshi side, but without the Golden Company, the Myrish did not believe they...
What the Myrish believe does not concern me. The free cities were always fighting one another. Their endless betrayals and alliances meant little and less to Westeros. Do you have any news or more import?
The slave revolt in Astapor has spread to Meereen, it would seem. Sailors of a dozen ships speak of dragons.
Harpies. It is harpies in Meereen. She remembered that from somewhere. Meereen was at the far end of the world, out east beyond Valyria. Let the slaves revolt. Why should I care? We keep no slaves in Westeros. Is that all you have for me?
There is some news from Dorne that your Grace may find of more interest. Prince Doran has imprisoned Sir Daemon Sand, a bastard who once squired for the Red Viper.
I recall him. Sir Daemon had been amongst the Dornish knights who had accompanied Prince Oberon to King's Landing. What did he do?
He demanded that Prince Oberon's daughters be set free.
More fool him.
Also,
Lord Qyburn said,
the daughter of the Knight of Spotswood was betrothed, quite unexpectedly, to Lord Eastermont. Our friends in Dorne inform us. She was sent to Greenstone that very night, and it is said she and Eastermont have already wed.
Well, a bastard in the belly would explain that. Cersei toyed with a lock of her hair. How old is the blushing bride?
23, Your Grace. Whereas Lord Eastermont must be 70,
I am aware of that. The Eastermonts were her good kin through Robert, whose father had taken one of them to wife in what must have been a fit of lust or madness. By the time Cersei wed the king, Robert's lady mother was long dead, though both of her brothers had turned up for the wedding and stayed for half a year.
Robert had later insisted on returning the courtesy with a visit to Eastermont, a mountainous little island off Cape Roth. The dank and dismal fortnight Cersei spent at Greenstone, the seat of House Estermont, was the longest of her young life. Jaime dubbed the castle Green Shit at first sight, and soon had Cersei doing it too. Elsewise, she passed her days watching her royal husband hawk, hunt, and drink with his uncles, and bludgeon various male cousins senseless in Greenshit's yard. There had been a female cousin, too, a chunky little widow with breasts as big as melons, whose husband and father had both died at Storm's End during the siege.
"Her father was good to me," Robert told her, "and she and I would play together when the two of us were small."
It did not take him long to start playing with her again. As soon as Cersei closed her eyes, the king would steal off to console the poor, lonely creature. One night she had Jaime follow him, to confirm her suspicions. When her brother returned, he asked her if she wanted Robert dead.
"No," she had replied, "I want him horned."
She liked to think that that was the night Joffrey was conceived. "Eldon Estermont has taken a wife 50 years his junior," she said to Kyburn. "Why should that concern me?" He shrugged.
"I do not say it should. But Daemon Sand and the Santigar girl were both close to Prince Doran's own daughter, Arianne. Or so the Dornishmen would have us believe. Perhaps it means little or less, but I thought your grace should know."
"Now I do." She was losing patience. "Do you have more?"
"One more thing, a trifling matter."
He gave her an apologetic smile and told her of a puppet show that had recently become popular amongst the city's small folk. A puppet show wherein the kingdom of the beasts was ruled by a pride of haughty lions.
"The puppet lions grow greedy and arrogant as this treasonous tale proceeds, until they begin to devour their own subjects. When the noble stag makes objection, the lions devour him as well, and roar that it is their right as the mightiest of beasts."
"And is that the end of it?" Cersei asked, amused. Looked at in the right light, it could be seen as a salutary lesson.
"No, your grace. At the end, a dragon hatches from an egg and devours all the lions."
The ending took the puppet show from simple insolence to treason. Witless fools! Only cretins would hazard their heads upon a wooden dragon. She considered a moment. "Send some of your whisperers to these shows and make note of who attends. If any of them should be men of note, I would know their names."
"What will be done with them, if I may be so bold?"
"Any men of substance shall be fined. Half their worth should be sufficient to teach them a sharp lesson and refill our coffers, without quite ruining them. Those too poor to pay can lose an eye for watching treason. For the puppeteers, the axe."
"There are 4. Perhaps your grace might allow me 2 of them for mine own purposes. A woman would be especially—"
"I gave you Sanel," the queen said sharply.
Alas, the poor girl is quite, exhausted."
Cersei did not like to think about that. The girl had come with her unsuspecting, thinking she was along to serve and pour. Even when Kyburn clapped the chain around her wrist, she had not seemed to understand. The memory still made the queen queasy. The cells were bitter cold, even the torches shivered, and that foul thing screaming in the darkness. "Yes, you may take a woman, 2, if it please you, but first I will have names."
"As you command."
Kyburn withdrew. Outside the sun was setting. Dorcas had prepared a bath for her. The queen was soaking pleasantly in the warm water and contemplating what she would say to her supper guests when Jaime came bursting through the door and ordered Jocelyn and Dorcas from the room. Her brother looked rather less than immaculate, and had a smell of horse about him.
He had Tommen with him, too. "Sweet sister," he said, "the king requires a word." Cersei's golden tresses floated in the bathwater. The room was steamy. A drop of sweat trickled down her cheek. "Tommen," she said, in a dangerously soft voice, "what is it now?" The boy knew that tone. He shrank back. "His grace wants his white courser on the morrow," Jamie said, "for his jousting lesson." She sat up in the tub. "There will be no jousting."
"Yes, there will."
Tommen puffed out his lower lip.
"I have to ride every day."
"And you shall," the queen declared, "once we have a proper master at arms to supervise your training."
"I don't want a proper master at arms. I want Sir Loras."
"You make too much of that boy. Your little wife has filled your head with foolish notions of his prowess."
"I know. But Sir Osmond Kettleblack is thrice the knight that Loras is."
Jamie laughed. "Not the Osmond Kettleblack I know." She could have throttled him. "Perhaps I need to command Sir Loras to allow Sir Osmond to unhorse him. That might chase the stars from Tommen's eyes. Salt a slug and shame a hero, and they shrink right up." "I'm sending for a Dornishman to train you," she said. "The Dornish are the finest justers in the realm."
"They are not," said Tommen. "Anyway, I don't want any stupid Dornishman. I want Sir Loras. I command it."
Jamie laughed. "He is no help at all. Does he think this amusing?" The queen slapped the water angrily. "Must I send for Pate? You do not command me. I am your mother."
"Yes, but I'm the king. Marjorie says that everyone has to do what the king says. I want my white courser saddled on the morrow so Sir Loras can teach me how to joust. I want a kitten, too, and I don't want to eat beets."
He crossed his arms. Jamie was still laughing. The queen ignored him. "Tommen, come here." When he hung back, she sighed. "Are you afraid? A king should not show fear." The boy approached the tub, his eyes downcast. She reached out and stroked his golden curls. "King or no, you are a little boy. Until you come of age, the rule is mine. You will learn to joust, I promise you, but not from Loras. The knights of the king's guard have more important duties than playing with a child. Ask the Lord Commander. Isn't that so, sir?" "Very important duties," Jamie smiled thinly. "Riding round the city walls, for an instance." Tommen looked close to tears.
"Can I still have a kitten?"
"Perhaps," the queen allowed, "so long as I hear no more nonsense about jousting. Can you promise me that?" He shuffled his feet.
"Yes."
"Good. Now run along. My guests will be here shortly." Tommen ran along, but before he left, he turned back to say,
"When I'm king, in my own right, I'm going to outlaw beats."
Her brother shoved the door shut with his stump. "Your grace," he said, when he and Cersei were alone, "I was wondering, are you drunk or merely stupid?" She slapped the water once again, sending up another splash to wash across his feet. "Guard your tongue, or what? Will you send me to inspect the city walls again?" He sat and crossed his legs. "Your bloody walls are fine. I've crawled over every inch of them, and had a look at all seven of the gates. The hinges on the iron gate are rusted, and the king's gate and mud gate need to be replaced after the pounding Stannis gave them with his rams. The walls are as strong as they have ever been, but perchance your grace has forgotten that our friends of Highgarden are inside the walls." "I forget nothing," she told him, thinking of a certain gold coin with a hand on one face and the head of a forgotten king on the other. "How did some miserable wretch of a jailer come to have such a coin hidden beneath his chamber pot? How does a man like Rugen come to have old gold from Highgarden? This is the first I've heard of a new master-at-arms. You'll need to look long and hard to find a better jouster than Loras Tyrell. Sir Loras is—" "I know what he is. I won't have him near my son," You had best remind him of his duties. Her bath was growing cool. He knows his duties, and there's no better lance. You were better before you lost your hand. Sir Barristan, when he was young. Arthur Dane was better, and Prince Rhaegar was a match for even him. Do not prate at me about how fierce the Flower is. He's just a boy. She was tired of Jaime balking her. No one had ever balked her lord father. When Tywin Lannister spoke, men obeyed. When Cersei spoke, they felt free to counsel her, to contradict her, even refuse her. It's all because I am a woman, because I cannot fight them with a sword. They gave Robert more respect than they give me, and Robert was a witless sot. She would not suffer it, especially not from Jaime. I need to rid myself of him, and soon. Once upon a time, she had dreamt that the two of them might rule the Seven Kingdoms side by side, but Jaime had become more of a hindrance than a help. Cersei rose from the bath. Water ran down her legs and trickled from her hair. When I want your counsel, I will ask for it. Leave me, sir. I must needs dress. Your supper guests, I know. What plot is this now? There are so many I lose track. His glance fell to the water, beading in the golden hair between her legs. He still wants me. Pining for what you've lost, brother? Jaime raised his eyes. I love you too, sweet sister. But you're a fool. A beautiful, golden fool. The word stung. You called me kinder words at Greenstone, the night you planted Joff inside me, Cersei thought. Get out! She turned her back on him and listened to him leave, fumbling at the door with his stump. Whilst Jocelyn was making certain that all was in readiness for the supper, Dorcas helped the queen into her new gown. It had stripes of shiny green satin alternating with stripes of plush black velvet, an intricate black mirrorish lace above the bodice. Mirrorish lace was costly, but it was necessary for a queen to look her best at all times, and her wretched washerwomen had shrunk several of her old gowns, so they no longer fit. She would have whipped them for their carelessness, but Tena had urged her to be merciful.
The small folk will love you more if you are kind, she had said.
So Cersa had ordered the value of the gowns deducted from the women's wage, a much more elegant solution. Dorcas put a silver looking-glass into her hand. Very good, the queen thought, smiling at her reflection. It was pleasant to be out of mourning. Black made her look too pale. A pity I'm not supping with Lady Merryweather, the queen reflected. It had been a long day, and Tena's wit always cheered her. Cersei had not had a friend she so enjoyed since Melara Heatherspoon, and Melara had turned out to be a greedy little schemer with ideas above her station. I should not think ill of her. She's dead and drowned, and she taught me never to trust anyone but Jaime. By the time she joined them in the Solar, her guests had made a good start on the Hippocras. Lady Felice not only looks like a fish, she drinks like one, she reflected, when she had made note of the half-empty flagon. Sweet Felice, she exclaimed, kissing the woman's cheek, and brave Sir Balmain, I was so distraught when I heard about your dear, dear mother. How fares our Lady Tander? Lady Felice looked as if she was about to cry. Oh, your grace is good to ask. Mother's hip was shattered by the fall, Maester Franklin says. He did what he could. Now we pray, but... Pray all you like. She will still be dead before the moon turns. Women as old as Tander Stokeworth do not survive a broken hip. I shall add my prayers to your own, said Cersei. Lord Kyburn tells me that Tander was thrown from her horse. Her saddle girth burst while she was riding, said Sir Balmain Birch. The stable boy should have seen the strap was worn. He has been chastised. Severely, I hope. The queen seated herself and indicated that her guests should sit as well. Will you have another cup of Hippocras, Felice? You're always fond of it.
I seem to recall.
It is so good of you to remember, Your Grace.
How could I have forgotten? Cersei thought. Jamie said it was a wonder you did not piss the stuff.
How was your journey? Uncomfortable, complained Felice. It rained most of the day. We sought to spend the night at Rosbury, but that young ward of Lord Giles refused us hospitality,
she snipped.
Mark my words, when Giles dies, that ill-born wretch will make off with his gold. He may even try and claim the lands and lordships, though by rights Rosbury should come to us when Giles passes. My lady mother was aunt to his second wife. Third cousin to Giles himself.
Is your sigil a lamb, my lady, or some sort of grasping monkey? Cersei thought.
Lord Giles has been threatening to die for as long as I have known him, but he's still with us, and will be for many years, I do hope.
She smiled pleasantly.
No doubt he will cough the whole lot of us into our graves. Like as not,
Sir Belman agreed.
Rosby's ward was not the only one to vex us, Your Grace. We encountered ruffians on the road as well. Filthy, unkempt creatures with leather shields and axes. Some had stars sewn on their jerkins, sacred stars of 7 points, but they had an evil look about them all the same. Oh, they were lice-ridden, I am certain, added Felice.
They call themselves sparrows, said Cersei. A plague upon the land. Our new High Septon will need to deal with them, once he is crowned. If not, I shall deal with them myself.
Has His High Holiness been chosen yet?
Asked Felice.
No,
the Queen had to confess.
Septon Olador was on the verge of being chosen until some of these sparrows followed him to a brothel and dragged him naked out into the street. Lucien seemed the likely choice now, though our friends on the other hill say he's still a few votes short of the required number. May the Crone guide the deliberations with her golden lamp of wisdom, said Lady Felice most piously.
Sir Belman shifted in his seat.
Your Grace, an awkward matter, but less bad feeling fester between us. You should know that neither my good wife nor her mother had any hand in the naming of this bastard child. Lollies is a simple creature, and her husband is given to black humours. I told him to choose a more fitting name for the boy. He laughed.
The Queen sipped her wine and studied him. Sir Belman had been a noted jouster once, and one of the handsomest knights in the Seven Kingdoms. He could still boast a handsome moustache. Elsewise, he had not aged well. His wavy blonde hair had retreated, whilst his belly advanced inexorably against his doublet. As a cat's paw, he leaves much to be desired, she reflected. Still, he should serve.
Tyrion was a king's name before the dragons came. The imp has despoiled it, but perhaps this child can restore the name to honour.
If the bastard lives so long.
I know you are not to blame. Lady Tander is the sister that I never had. And you?
Her voice broke.
Forgive me. I live in fear.
Felice opened and closed her mouth, which made her look like some especially stupid fish.
In fear, Your Grace.
I have not slept a whole night through since Joffrey died. Cersei filled the goblets with hypocras. My friends, you are my friends, I hope. And King Tommen's?
Oh, that sweet lad,
Sir Balmain declared.
Your Grace, the very words of House Tokeworth are proud to be faithful.
Would that there were more like you, good sir. I tell you truly, I have grave doubts about Sir Bronn of the Blackwater. Husband and wife exchanged a look.
The man is insolent, Your Grace,
Felice said.
Uncouth and foul-mouthed. He is no true knight,
Sir Balmain said.
No,
Cersei smiled all for him, and you are a man who would know true knighthood. I remember watching you joust in, which tourney was it, where you fought so brilliantly, sir? He smiled modestly.
Oh, that affair, Doskendale. 6 years ago. No, you were not there, else you would surely have been crowned the Queen of Love and Beauty. Was it the tourney at Lannisport after Greyjoy's rebellion? I unhorsed many a good knight in that one.
That was the one. Her face grew somber. The imp vanished the night my father died, leaving two honest jailers behind in pools of blood. Some claim he fled across the narrow sea, but I wonder. The dwarf is cunning. Perhaps he still lurks near, planning more murders. Perhaps some friend is hiding him.
Bronn?
Sir Balmont stroked his bushy moustache. He was ever the imp's creature. Only the stranger knows how many men he sent to hell at Tyrion's behest.
Your Grace, I think I should have noticed the dwarf skulking about our lands,
said Sir Balmont. My brother is small. He was made for skulking. Cersei let her hand shake. A child's name is a small thing, but insolence, unpunished, breeds rebellion. And this man Bronn has been gathering sellswords to him. Qyburn has told me.
He has taken four knights into his household,
said Felice. Sir Balmont snorted.
My good wife flatters them to call them knights. They're up jump sellswords, with not a thimble of chivalry to be found amongst the four of them.
As I feared, Bronn is gathering swords for the dwarf. May the Seven save my little son. The imp will kill him as he killed his brother. She sobbed.
My friends, I put my honour in your hands. But what is a queen's honour against a mother's fears? Oh, say on, Your Grace, Sir Balmont assured her. Your word shall ne'er leave this room.
Cersei reached across the table and gave his hand a squeeze.
I would sleep more easily of a night if I were to hear that Sir Bronn had suffered a mishap. Whilst hunting, perhaps?
Sir Balmont considered for a moment.
A mortal mishap?
No, I desire you to break his little toe. She had to bite her lip. My enemies are everywhere, and my friends are fools.
I beg you, sir,
she whispered. Do not make me say it.
Oh, I understand.
Sir Balmont raised a finger.
A turnip would have grasped it quicker.
You are a true knight indeed, sir.
The answer to a frightened mother's prayers. Cersei kissed him.
Do it quickly, if you would. Bronn has only a few men about him now, but if we do not act, he will surely gather more.
She kissed Felice. I shall never forget this, my friends. My true friends of Stokeworth. Proud to be faithful? You have my word. We shall find Lollis a better husband when this is done. A kettle black, perhaps. We Lannisters pay our debts. The rest was hippocras and buttered beets, hot-baked bread, herb-crusted pike, and ribs of wild boar. Cersei had become very fond of boar since Robert's death. She did not even mind the company, though Felice simpered and Borman preened from soup to sweet. It was past midnight before she could rid herself of them. Sir Balmont proved a great one for suggesting yet another flagon, and the Queen did not think it prudent to refuse. I could have hired a faceless man to kill Bronn for half of what I spent on hippocras, she reflected when they were gone at last. At that hour her son was fast asleep, but Cersei looked in upon him before seeking her own bed. She was surprised to find three black kittens cuddled up beside him.
Where did those come from?
She asked Sir Meryn Trent, outside the royal bedchamber.
The little queen gave them to him. She only meant to give him one, but he couldn't decide which one he liked best.
Better than cutting them out of their mother with a dagger, I suppose. Marjorie's clumsy attempts at seduction were so obvious as to be laughable. Tommen is too young for kisses, so she gives him kittens. Cersei rather wished they were not black, though. Black cats brought ill luck. As Rhaegar's little girl had discovered in this very castle, she would have been my daughter if the mad king had not played his cruel jape on father. It had to have been the madness that sent Ares to refuse Lord Tywin's daughter, and take his son instead, whilst marrying his own son to a feeble Dornish princess with black eyes and a flat chest. The memory of the rejection still rankled, even after all these years. Many nights she had watched Prince Rhaegar in the hall, playing his silver-stringed harp with those long, elegant fingers of his. Had any man ever been so beautiful? He was more than a man, though. His blood was the blood of old Valyria, the blood of dragons and gods. When she was just a little girl, her father had promised her that she would marry Rhaegar. She could not have been more than 6 or 7.
"Never speak of it, child,"
he had told her, smiling his secret smile that only Cersei ever saw.
"Not until his grace agrees to the betrothal. It must remain our secret for now."
And so it had, though once she had drawn a picture of herself flying behind Rhaegar on a dragon, her arms wrapped tight about his chest. When Jaime had discovered it, she told him it was Queen Alysanne and King Jaehaerys. She was 10 when she finally saw her prince in the flesh, at the tourney her lord father had thrown to welcome King Ares to the west. Viewing stands had been raised beneath the walls of Lannisport, and the cheers of the small folk had echoed of Castle Rock like rolling thunder. They cheered father twice as loudly as they cheered the king. The queen recalled, but only half as loudly as they cheered Prince Rhaegar. 17 and new to knighthood, Rhaegar Targaryen had worn black plate over golden ringmail when he cantered onto the lists. Long streamers of red and gold and orange silk had floated behind his helm like flames. 2 of her uncles fell before his lance, along with a dozen of her father's finest jousters, the flower of the West. By night, the prince played his silver harp and made her weep. When she had been presented to him, Cersei had almost drowned in the depths of his sad purple eyes. "He has been wounded," she recalled thinking, "but I will mend his hurt when we are wed." Next to Rhaegar, even her beautiful Jaime had seemed no more than a callow boy. "The prince is going to be my husband," she had thought, giddy with excitement. "And when the old king dies, I'll be the queen." Her aunt had confided that truth to her before the tourney.
"You must be especially beautiful,"
Lady Jenna told her, fussing with her dress,
"for at the final feast it shall be announced that you and Prince Rhaegar are betrothed."
Cersei had been so happy that day. Elsewise she would never have dared visit the tent of Maggie the Frog. She had only done it to show Jean and Melara that the lioness fears nothing. "I was going to be a queen. Why should a queen be afraid of some hideous old woman?" The memory of that foretelling still made her flesh crawl a lifetime later. "Jane ran shrieking from the tent in fear," the queen remembered. "But Melara stayed, and so did I. We let her taste our blood and laughed at her stupid prophecies. None of them made the least bit of sense. She was going to be Prince Rhaegar's wife, no matter what the woman said. Her father had promised it, and Tywin Lannister's word was gold. Her laughter died at tourney's end. There had been no final feast, no toasts to celebrate her betrothal to Prince Rhaegar, only cold silences and chilly looks between the king and her father. Later, when Ares and his son and all his gallant knights had departed for King's Landing, the girl had gone to her aunt in tears, not understanding.
"Your father proposed the match," Lady Jenna told her, "but Ares refused to hear of it. You are my most able servant, Tywin. The king said, but a man does not marry his heir to his servant's daughter. Dry those tears, little one. Have you ever seen a lion weep? Your father will find another man for you, a better man than Rhaegar."
Her aunt had lied, though, and her father had failed her, just as Jaime was failing her now.
Father found no better man. Instead, he gave me Robert, and Maggie's curse bloomed like some poisonous flower. If she had only married Rhaegar, as the gods intended, he would never have looked twice at the wolf girl. Rhaegar would be our king today, and I would be his queen, the mother of his sons. She had never forgiven Robert for killing him. But then, lions were not good at forgiving, as Sir Bronn of the Blackwater would shortly learn. Brain. It was Hyle Hunt who insisted that they take the heads.
"Tarry will want them for the walls," he said.
"We have no tar," Brain pointed out. "The flesh will rot. Leave them."
She did not want to travel through the green gloom of the piney woods with the heads of the men she'd killed. Hunt would not listen. He hacked through the dead men's necks himself, tied the three heads together by the hair, and slung them from his saddle. Brain had no choice but to try and pretend they were not there. But sometimes, especially at night, she could feel their dead eyes on her back, and once she dreamed she heard them whispering to one another. It was cold and wet on Crackclaw Point as they retraced their steps. Some days it rained, and some days it threatened rain. They were never warm. Even when they made camp, it was hard to find enough dry wood for a fire. By the time they reached the gates of Maidenpool, a host of flies attended them. A crow had eaten Shagwell's eyes, and Pig and Timian were crawling with maggots. Brian and Podrick had long since taken to riding 100 yards ahead, to keep the smell of rot well behind them. Sir Hyle claimed to have lost all sense of smell by then.
"Bury them,"
she told him, every time they made camp for a night. But Hunt was nothing if not stubborn.
"He will most like tell Lord Randall that he slew all three of them."
To his honour, though, the knight did nothing of the sort.
The stammering squire threw a rock," he said when he and Brian were ushered into Tarly's presence in the yard of Mouton's castle.
The heads had been presented to a sergeant of the guard, who was told to have them cleaned and tarred and mounted above the gate. "The swords wench did the rest."
"All three?"
Lord Randall was incredulous.
"The way she fought, she could have killed three more."
"And did you find the Stark girl?"
Tarly demanded of her.
No, my lord.
"Instead, you slew some rats. Did you enjoy it?"
"No, my lord."
"A pity. Well, you've had your taste of blood. Prove whatever it is you're meant to prove. It's time you took off that mail and donned proper clothes again. There are ships in port. One's bound to stop at Tarth. I'll have you on it." "Thank you, my lord, but no."
Lord Tarly's face suggested he would like nothing better than to stick her own head on a spike and mount it above the gates of Maidenpool with Timian, Pig, and Shagwell.
"You mean to continue with this, Polly?"
"I mean to find the Lady Sansa."
"If it please, my lord,"
Sir Hyle said.
"I watched her fight the mummers. She is stronger than most men and quick."
The sword is quick," Tarly snapped. "That is the nature of Valyrian steel. Stronger than most men, aye. She is a freak of nature. Far be it for me to deny it." "Oh, his sort would never love me," Brienne thought, "no matter what I do. My lord, it may be that Sandor Clegane has some knowledge of the girl. If I could find him."
"Clegane's turned outlaw. He rides with Beric Dondarrion now, it would seem. Or not, the tales vary. Show me where they're hiding. I will gladly sit their bellies open, pull their entrails out, and burn them. We've hanged dozens of outlaws, but the leaders still elude us. Clegane, Dondarrion, the Red Priest, and now this woman, Stoneheart. How do you propose to find them, when I cannot?"
"My lord, I..."
She had no good answer for him.
"All I can do is try."
"Try, then. You have your letter. You do not need my leave, but I'll give it nonetheless. If you're fortunate, all you get for your trouble are saddle sores.
If not, perhaps Clegane will let you live after he and his pack are done raping you. You can crawl back to Tarth with some dog's bastard in your belly. Brian ignored that.
If it please, my lord, how many men ride with a hound?
Six or 60 or 600. Would seem to depend on whom we ask. Randall Tarley had plainly had enough of the conversation. He started to turn away.
If my squire and I might beg your hospitality until...
Beg all you want. I will not suffer you beneath my roof. Sir Hal Hunt stepped forward.
If it please, my lord, I had understood that it was still Lord Mouton's roof.
Tarley gave the knight a venomous look.
Mouton has the courage of a worm. You will not speak to me of Mouton. As for you, my lady, it is said that your father is a good man. If so, I pity him. Some men are blessed with sons, some with daughters. No man deserves to be cursed with such as you. Live or die, Lady Brian. Do not return to Maidenpool whilst I rule here.
Words are wind, Brian told herself. They cannot hurt you. Let them wash over you. As you command, my lord, she tried to say, but Tarley had gone before she got it out.
She walked from the yard like one asleep, not knowing where she was going. Sir Hyle fell in beside her. There are inns. She shook her head. She did not want words with Hyle Hunt. Do you recall the stinking goose?
Her cloak still smelled of it.
Why? Meet me there on the morrow at midday. My cousin Aelin was one of those sent out to find the hound. I'll speak with him.
Why would you do that?
Why not? If you succeed where Aelin failed, I shall be able to taunt him with that for years.
There were still inns in Maidenpool. Sir Hyle had not been wrong. Some had burned during one sack or the other, however, and had yet to be rebuilt, and those that remained were full to bursting with men from Lord Tarley's host. She and Podrick visited all of them that afternoon, but there were no beds to be had anywhere.
Sir, my lady, Podrick said as the sun was going down, there are ships. Ships have beds, hammocks, or bunks.
Lord Randall's men still prowled the docks, as thick as the flies had been on the heads of the three bloody mummers, but their sergeant knew Brian by sight and let her pass. The local fisherfolk were tying up for the night and crying the day's catch, but her interest was in the larger ships that plied the stormy waters of the narrow sea. Half a dozen were in port, though one, a galleass called the Titan's Daughter, was casting off her lines to ride out the evening tide. She and Podrick Payne made the rounds of the ships that remained. The master of the Gulltown Girl took Brian for a whore, and told them that his ship was not a bawdy house, and a harpooner on the Ebony's Whaler offered to buy her boy, but they had better fortune elsewhere. She purchased Podrick an orange on the Sea Strider, a cog just in from Old Town by way of Tyrosh, Pentos, and Duskendale.
Gulltown next, the captain told her. Thence round the fingers to Sisterton and White Harbour, if the storms allow. She's a clean ship, Strider, not so many rats as most, and will have fresh eggs and new churned butter aboard. Is milady seeking passage north?
No.
Not yet. She was tempted, but as they were making their way to the next pier, Podrick shuffled to his feet and said,
Sir, my lady, what if my lady did go home? My other lady, I mean, Sir Lady Sansa.
Or they burned her home.
Still, that's where her gods are, and gods can't die.
Gods can't die, but girls can.
Timian was a cruel man and a murderer, but I do not think he lied about the hound. We cannot go north until we know for certain. There will be other ships.
At the east end of the harbour, they finally found shelter for the night, aboard a storm-wracked trading galley called the Lady of Myr. She was listing badly, having lost her mast and half her crew in a storm. But her master did not have the coin he needed to refit her. so he was glad to take a few pennies from Brian and allow her and Pod to share an empty cabin. They had a restless night. Thrice Brian woke, once when the rain began, and once at a creak that made her think Nimble Dick was creeping in to kill her. The second time she woke with a knife in hand, but it was nothing. In the darkness of the cramped little cabin, it took her a moment to remember that Nimble Dick was dead. When she finally drifted back to sleep, she dreamed about the men she'd killed. They danced around her, mocking her, pinching at her as she slashed at them with her sword. She cut them, all to bloody ribbons. Yet still they swarmed around her. Shagwell, Timian, and Pig, aye. But Randall Tarley, too, and Varga Hote, and Red Ronnet Connington. Ronnet had a rose between his fingers. When he held it out to her, she cut his hand off. She woke sweating, and spent the rest of the night huddled under her cloak, listening to rain pound against the deck over her head. It was a wild night. From time to time, she heard the sound of distant thunder, and thought of the Bravassi ship that had sailed upon the evening tide. The next morning she found the stinking goose again, woke its slatternly proprietor, and paid her for some greasy sausages, fried bread, half a cup of wine, a flagon of boiled water, and two clean cups. The woman squinted at Brian as she was putting the water on to boil.
"You're the big one. Went off with Nimble Dick, I remember. He cheat you?"
"No."
"Rape you?"
"No."
"Steal your horse?"
"No. He was slain by outlaws."
"Outlaws?"
The woman seemed more curious than upset.
"I always figured Dick would hang, or get sent off to that wall."
They ate the fried bread and half the sausages. Podrick Payne washed his down with wine-flavoured water, whilst Brian nursed a cup of watered wine and wondered why she'd come. Hyal Hunt was no true knight. His honest face was just a mummer's mask.
"I do not need his help. I do not need his protection. And I do not need him," she told herself. "He's probably not even coming. Telling me to meet him here was just another jape."
She was getting up to go when Sir Hyal arrived.
"My lady, Podrick."
He glanced at the cups and plates and the half-eaten sausages cooling in a puddle of grease and said,
"Gods, I hope you did not eat the food here."
"What we ate is no concern of yours," Brain said. "Did you find your cousin? What did he tell you?"
"Xander Clegane was last seen in Salt Pens the day of the raid. Afterward he rode west along the Trident."
She frowned.
"A Trident is a long river."
"Aye, but I don't think our dog will have wandered too far from its mouth. Westeros has lost its charm for him, it will seem. At Salt Pens he was looking for a ship."
Sir Hyal drew a roll of sheepskin from his boot, pushed the sausages aside, and unrolled it. It proved to be a map.
"A hound butchered three of his brother's men at the old inn by the crossroads here. He led the raid on Salt Pans here."
He tapped Salt Pans with his finger.
"He may be trapped. The Freys are up here at the Twins. Dairy and Harrenhal are south, across the Trident. West, he's got the Blackwoods and the Brackens fighting. And Lord Randall's here at Maidenpool. The high road to the Vale is closed by snow. Even if he could get past the mountain clans. Where's the dog to go?"
"If he is with Dondarrion..."
"He's not. Aelin is certain of that. Dondarrion's men are looking for him, too. They put out word that they mean to hang him for what he did at Salt Pans. They had no part of that. Lord Randall is putting it about that they did, in hopes of turning the commons against Beric and his brotherhood. He will never take the Lightning Lord so long as the small folk are protecting him. And there's this other band led by this woman, Stoneheart. Lord Beric's lover, according to one tale. Supposedly, she was hanged by the Freys, but Dondarrion kissed her and brought her back to life. And now she cannot die, no more than he can.
Brian considered the map. If Clegane was last seen at Saltpans, that would be the place to find his trail.
There is no one left at Saltpans, but an old knight hiding in his castle, Aelin said.
Still, it would be a place to start.
There's a man, Sir Hyle said, a septon. He came in through my gate the day before you turned up. Merryball, his name is, riverborn and riverbred, and he's served here all his life. He's departing on the morrow to make his circuit, and he always calls at Saltpans. We should go with him.
Brian looked up sharply.
We? I'm going with you.
You're not.
Well, I'm going with Septon Merryball to Saltpans. You and Podrick can go wherever you bloody well like.
Did Lord Randall command you to follow me again?
He commanded me to stay away from you. Lord Randall is of the view that you might benefit from a good hard raping.
Then why would you come with me?
It was that, or return to gate duty.
If your lord commanded,
he's no longer my lord.
That took her aback. You left his service?
His lordship informed me that he had no further need of my sword, or my insolence. It amounts to the same thing. Henceforth I shall enjoy the adventurous life of a hedge knight. Though if we do find Sansa Stark, I imagine we will be well rewarded.
Golden land. That's what he sees in us. I mean to save the girl, not sell her. I swore a vow.
I don't recall that I did.
That is why you will not be coming with me. They left the next morning as the sun was coming up. It was a queer procession. Sir Hyle on a chestnut courser, and Brian on her tall grey mare. Podrick Payne astride his swayback stot, and Septon Merribald walking beside them with his quarterstaff, leading a small donkey and a large dog. The donkey carried such a heavy load that Brian was afraid its back would break.
"Food for the poor and hungry of the Riverlands,"
Septon Merribald told them at the gates of Maidenpool.
"Seeds and nuts and dried fruit, oaten porridge, flour, barley bread, 3 wheels of yellow cheese from the inn by the Fool's Gate, salt cod for me, salt mutton for dog, salt. Onions, carrots, turnips, 2 sacks of beans, 4 of barley, and 9 of oranges. Oh, I have a weakness for the orange, I confess. I got these from a sailor, and I fear they will be the last I'll taste till spring."
Merribald was a septon without a sept, only one step up from a begging brother in the hierarchy of the faith. There were hundreds like him, a ragged band whose humble task it was to trudge from one fly-speck of a village to the next, conducting holy services, performing marriages, and forgiving sins. Those he visited were expected to feed and shelter him, but most were as poor as he was, so Merribald could not linger in one place too long without causing hardship to his hosts. Kindly innkeepers would sometimes allow him to sleep in their kitchens or their stables, and there were septries and holdfasts, and even a few castles where he knew he would be given hospitality. Where no such places were at hand, he slept beneath the trees or under hedges.
"There are many fine hedges in the Riverlands,"
Merriwald said.
"The old ones are the best. There's nothing beats a 100-year-old hedge. Inside one of those, a man can sleep as snug as in an inn, and with less fear of fleas."
The septon could neither read nor write, as he cheerfully confessed along the road. But he knew 100 different prayers and could recite long passages from the 7-pointed star from memory, which was all that was required in the villages. He had a seamed, wind-burnt face, a shock of thick grey hair, wrinkles at the corner of his eyes. Though a big man, 6 feet tall, he had a way of hunching forward as he walked that made him seem much shorter. His hands were large and leathery, with red knuckles and dirt beneath the nails, and he had the biggest feet that Brian had ever seen, bare and black
and hard as horn. "I have not worn a shoe in 20 years, he told Brian. "The first year I had more blisters than I had toes, and my soles would bleed like pigs whenever I trod on a hard stone. But I prayed, and the cobbler above turned my skin to leather."
"There is no cobbler above," Podrick protested.
"There is, lad, though you may call him by another name. Tell me, which of the 7 gods you love best?"
"The warrior," said Podrick, without a moment's hesitation.
Brain cleared her throat.
"At evenfall, my father Septon always said there was but one god."
"One god with 7 aspects. That's so, my lady, and you are right to point it out. But the mystery of the 7 who are one is not easy for simple folk to grasp, and I'm nothing if not simple. So I speak of 7 gods."
Mirabeau turned back to Podrick.
"I've never known a boy who did not love the warrior. I'm old, though, and being old, I love the smith. Without his labour, what would the warrior defend? Every town has a smith, and every castle. They make the ploughs we need to plant our crops, the nails we use to build our ships, iron shoes to save the hooves of our faithful horses, the bright swords of our lords. No one could doubt the value of a smith, and so we name one of the 7 in his honour. But we might as easily have called him the farmer, or the fisherman, the carpenter, or the cobbler. What he works at makes no matter. What matters is, he works. The father rules, the warrior fights, the smith labours, and together they perform all that is rightful for a man. Just as the smith is one aspect of the godhead, the cobbler is one aspect of the smith. It was he who heard my prayer and healed my feet."
"And the gods are good," Sir Hyle said in a dry voice. "But why trouble them, when you might just have kept your shoes?
Going barefoot was my penance. Even holy septons can be sinners, and my flesh was weak as weak could be. I was young and full of sap, and the girls, a septon can seem as gallant as a prince, if he is the only man you know who has ever been more than a mile from your village. I would recite to them from the 7-pointed star. The maiden's book worked best. I was a wicked man before I threw away my shoes. It shames me to think of all the maidens I deflowered."
Brian shifted in the saddle uncomfortably, thinking back to the camp below the walls of Highgarden, and the wager Sir Hyle and the others had made to see who could bed her first.
"We're looking for a maiden," confided Podrick Payne, "a high-born girl of 3 and 10, with auburn hair.
I had understood that you were seeking outlaws."
"Them too,"
Podrick admitted.
"Most travellers do all they can to avoid such men," said Septon Marybold. "Yet you would seek them out."
"We only seek one outlaw," Brian said. "The hound."
"So Sir Hyle told me. May the 7 save you, child. It said he leaves a trail of butchered babes and ravished maids behind him. The mad dog of Saltpan, I've heard him called. What would good folk want with such a creature?"
"The maid that Podrick spoke of may be with him."
"Truly. And then we must pray for the poor girl."
"And for me," thought Brian. "A prayer for me as well. Ask the crone to raise her lamp and lead me to the Lady Sansa, and the warrior to give strength to my arm so that I might defend her."
She did not say the words aloud, though. Not where Hyle Hunt might hear her and mock her for her woman's weakness. With Septon Marybold afoot, and his donkey bearing such a heavy load, the going was slow all that day. They did not take the main road west, the road that Brian had once ridden with Sir Jamie when they came the other way to find Maidenpool sacked and full of corpses. Instead, they struck off toward the northwest, following the shore of the Bay of Crabs, on a crooked track so small that it did not appear on either of Sir Hyle's precious sheepskin maps.
The steep hills, black bogs, and piney woods of Crackclaw Point were nowhere to be found this side of Maidenpool. The lands they travelled through were low and wet, a wilderness of sandy dunes and salt marshes beneath a vast blue-grey vault of sky. The road was prone to vanishing amongst the reeds and tidal pools, only to appear again a mile further on. Without Merrybell, Brian knew they surely would have lost their way. The ground was often soft, so in places the Septon would walk ahead, tapping with his quarterstaff to make certain of the footing. There were no trees for leagues around, just sea and sky and sand. No land could have been more different from Tarth, with its mountains and waterfalls, its high meadows and shadowed vales, yet this place had its own beauty, Brian thought. They crossed a dozen slow-flowing streams, alive with frogs and crickets, watched terns floating high above the bay, heard the sandpipers calling from amongst the dunes. Once a fox crossed their path and set Merrybull's dog to barking wildly. And there were people, too. Some lived amongst the reeds in houses built of mud and straw, whilst others fished the bay in leather coracles, and built their homes on rickety wooden stilts above the dunes. Most seemed to live alone, out of sight of any human habitation but their own. They seemed a shy folk, for the most part, but near midday the dog began to bark again, and three women emerged from the reeds to give Merrybold a woven basket full of clams. He gave each of them an orange in return. Though clams were as common as mud in this world, and oranges were rare and costly. One of the women was very old, one was heavy with child, and one was a girl as fresh and pretty as a flower in spring. When Merrybell took them off to hear their sins, Sir Hyle chuckled and said, "It would seem the gods walk with us, at least the maiden, the mother, and the crone." Podrick looked so astonished that Brian had to tell him no. They were only three marsh women. Afterward, when they resumed their journey, she turned to the Septon and said, "Are these people live less than a day's ride from Maidenpool, and yet the fighting has not touched them?" "They have little to touch, my lady. Their treasures are shells and stones and leather bolts, their finest weapons, knives of rusted iron. They are born, they live, they love, they die. They know Lord Mouton rules their lands, but few have ever seen him. And River Run and King's Landing are only names to them." "And yet they know the gods," said Brain. "That is your work, I think. How long have you walked the riverlands?"
"It will be 40 years soon," the Septon said, and his dog gave a loud bark. "From Maidenpool to Maidenpool, my circuit takes me half a year, and oft times more. But I will not say I know the trident. Oh, I glimpse the castles of a great lord only at a distance. But I know the market towns and holdfasts, the villages too small to have a name, the hedges and the hills, the rills where a thirsty man can drink, and the caves where he can shelter, and the roads the small folk use, the crooked, muddy tracks that do not appear on parchment maps. Oh, I know them too," he chuckled. "I should. My feet have trod every mile of them 10 times over.
The back roads are the ones the outlaws use, and the caves would make fine places for hunted men to hide." A prickle of suspicion made Brian wonder just how well Sir Hyle knew this man.
"That must be a lonely life, Septon."
"The servants are always with me," said Merrybold, "and I have my faithful servant and dog."
Does your dog have a name?" asked Podrick Payne.
"He must," said Merrybold. "But he's not my dog, not him."
The dog barked and wagged his tail. It was a huge, shaggy creature, 10 stone of dog at least, but friendly.
"Who does he belong to?" asked Podrick.
"Why, to himself, and to the Seven. As to his name, he's not told me what it is. I call him Dog."
"Oh."
Podrick did not know what to make of a dog named Dog, plainly. The boy chewed on that for a while and then said,
I used to have a dog when I was little. I called him Hero."
"Was he?"
"Was he what?" "A hero." No, he was a good dog, though. He died.
Dog kept me safe upon the roads. Even in such trying times as these, neither wolf nor outlaw dare molest me when dog is at my side.
The Septon frowned.
The wolves have grown terrible of late. There are places where a man alone would do well to find a tree to sleep in. In all my years, the biggest pack I ever saw had fewer than a dozen wolves in it, but the great pack that prowls along the Trident now numbers in the hundreds. Have you come on them yourself?
Sir Hyle asked.
I have been spared that. Seven saved me, but I have heard them in the night, and more than once. Oh, so many voices, a sound to curdle a man's blood. It even set dog to shivering, and dog has killed a dozen wolves.
He ruffled the dog's head.
Some would tell you that they are demons. They say the pack is led by a monstrous she-wolf, a stalking shadow, grim and grey and huge. They will tell you that she has been known to bring Oryx down all by herself, and that no trap nor snare can hold her, that she fears neither steel nor fire, slays any wolf that tries to mount her, and devours no other flesh but man.
Sir Hyle Hunt laughed.
Now you've done it, Septon. Poor Podrick's eyes are big as boiled eggs.
They're not,
said Podrick, indignant. Dog barked. That night they made a cold camp in the dunes. Brian sent Podrick walking by the shore to find some driftwood for a fire, but he came back empty-handed, with mud up to his knees.
The tide's out, sir, my lady. There's no water, only mud flats.
Stay off the mud, child, counseled Septon Meribald. The mud is not fond of strangers. If you walk in the wrong place, it will open up and swallow you.
It's only mud,